start out a first grader on the quadratic equation.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. We are here live tonight at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C. Really a great collection of everything green, everything renewable, recyclable, you name it, reusable. It's all here, how we make the green economy, how we move forward and create the jobs that are so desperately needed while saving our planet. And, you know, we're going to talk to a bunch of folks tonight who are presenters and folks who are attending the conference, some interesting individuals. So you're going to want to stick around through all of that. But before we get into all that, I met a guy just... grabbed my attention. Some great music. We're going to play a clip of it at the end here. But Mr. Organic I have sitting in front of me. How are we doing tonight, Mr. Organic?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself, Rick?
You know, I got to tell you, completely blown away by the music clips I heard earlier. Mm-hmm. Really, honestly, and truthfully, I think what you're doing, and we're going to talk about what you're doing, I think is important. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners what it is you are embarking upon?
Well, my name is Marvin Butler. They call me Mr. Organic. I'm the author of a children's book, Mr. Organic, Recycling from A to Z. It's being well received across Tennessee, and I'm here in Washington, D.C. to make it a national event for the people all over the country. I'm meeting people all over the country that's showing interest in the book. I'm trying to get in the curriculum. I'm also the singer on an up-and-coming CD, Mr. Organic Environmental Songs for All Ages. It's a CD that you can put in and... Everyone from the young child up to the oldest person in the family would like the songs that's on the CD. It's to encourage people that's in the environmental movement, and it's the music that's going to help move the movement forward, because for years there have not been any environmental songs that really the kind of touched on what's going on. And I have a song right now, well, what you listen to is We Can Reverse Global Warming, that's being well received. And I'm in the process of putting it out so everybody can listen to it all over the country and all over the world.
Yeah, there are a couple of YouTube videos we looked at. We're going to put links to our site at thericksmithshow.com for Mr. Organic to give you the opportunity to go hear off just an amazing voice. I got to give you credit, man. You have got a great voice.
Well, thank you. It's a blessing, and it's also a gift. It's a blessing to be able to use your passion, and people see that something that you just love to do, and you're able to touch people with what you do. So it's just a great opportunity to come down here to Washington, D.C. I've met people from different states and different cities. And basically I've just been in Tennessee and Nashville and Lebanon. But to come here and to actually get so many people that's really interested in my music, it's a great feeling, because you go from the studio not knowing if people will love your music to actually getting your music out and people loving it. So I just want to put it out to the masses of the world. to this country and let them know that going green is not a bad thing. Everybody can go green and also make money at the same time, create jobs for American people, and focus on putting American people to work, and just focus on really doing what's positive with the environmental movement, which is really not negative. It's a lot of positive things with the environmental movement.
Yep. You know, like you said in the one video, you're not afraid of that green ghost.
Not afraid of green ghost.
Why
because,
not?
Because the green ghost also brings opportunity with green money, also with opportunities with teaching people that going green means also taking your waste and turning it into money, being more resourceful, being more available to letting people know that green is a good thing, especially when you make money doing it.
So you're here at this conference, the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference, which, you know, I think this is the third annual event that they've had this, and it's grown every year that I can recall. What kind of outreach are you doing here? What kind of networking are you doing here at the conference?
Well, I'm here because I'm a member of the Sierra Club in Memphis, Environmental Justice Program. The Sierra Club, I've been a member here less than a year, and it's a great organization. I advise anyone that if you're not a member of the Sierra Club, that get involved with it, because for the small fee of joining the Sierra Club is great. I join and I go to meetings. I meet a lot of people, and it's good to network with people that know what you're talking about.
In Memphis?
Yes.
In Memphis, Tennessee?
In Memphis, Tennessee, yes.
Really?
Memphis is going green. Yeah. And Memphis is also going green. So it's just changing. A lot of people are understanding now that this is not a host. Like in the song I said, people think this is a host, and they think it's a green ghost. But it's not, and it's actually a good thing. And if people stop pushing on the wrong buttons and start pushing the right button, we can actually make this move for a better effort for the whole world.
And, you know, and for me, a lot of this comes down to some very common sense things. And I understand
right.
You do a lot of work with kids.
Right.
So you have to really boil it down to the very simple
right.
components,
right.
which are, you know, this is common sense stuff. You do it because it's good for the planet. It's good for, for you, it's good. It's good all around.
Well, you don't necessarily have to be a rocket scientist. You know, I mean, you don't have to be a genius. I mean, you know, you don't have to be this hard core on this thing. It's just common sense. If you are throwing away 90% of your product, if you start recycling 50% of the product, you're still throwing away 50%. But in that 50%, you're probably going to create thousands of jobs from this waste that you create. So you can put Americans to work off waste, or you can waste it and not put Americans to work. I don't understand. It's not a rocket science.
Yeah, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure this out. But here's the thing. I know my daughter, who's 8, you know, she gets it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her school just put a solar array in the school that's going to take that school completely off the grid.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be actually able to save money by selling mm-hmm. back to the grid. She gets it
mm-hmm.
because it's been part of her life. For those of us who... You know, maybe it wasn't always front and center.
Mm-hmm.
It is a little bit of adjustment, I think.
Well, I have a term that I use in We Can Reverse Global Warming that goes, we need the young, not so young, and in between. That includes everybody. But the ones that are more eager and more easier to get involved with this are the young people. In World War II, recycling is what really saved the war, because we recycled a lot of our products. That actually got us over in World War II. The history will show this, that the young people were the ones that collected the paper, they collected the tires, they collected the tin, and this was the effort collectively with the young and the not so young and in between, and we can do the same thing with the war that we have now going on with the Democrats fighting against the Republicans and the Independent. He just got his vote in just to screw up everything. So, but if they all would just pull together and just understand that the youth are concerned about their future, and we are concerned about our future also.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and the book, talk a second for the book. How can we get it? When will it be available, all of that?
Right now, we have galleys, and these are books that we're going to really send out to all the major newspapers. It's Mr. Organic, Recycled from A to Z is the title. I have letters from different organizations, awards from the Sierra Club, Blacks Living Green Award last year, and also the Environmental Education Award from the Chickasaw Group in Memphis, Tennessee. I have letters from school teachers, educators, and also I was a keynote speaker at Lamoine Owen College, where I was a mentor in a green, teaching the students how to go green and teaching them recycling. And I took my book to the school, and what it is that this is one of the few children's books where college students also learn. And see, I have a Mr. Organic Recycling from A to Z guarantee. I guarantee that the first time you pick this book up and read on the cyclings, when you put it down, the first thing it would say is that I learned something today.
All right. Well, Mr. Organic, we're going to play one of the great songs, and I hope you will send us some of your music so we can throw it into our rotation.
I would be more than happy to, Rick. This is a great opportunity. I thank you for letting me have this time with you, and I look forward to us possibly getting the music out to the masses of the people and to the world, and I thank you for your time.
All righty, Mr. Organic. We're going to take a quick break. Live from the Blue Green Alliance Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're right back after this.
It would take combining efforts all over the world from fellow man. This earth is all of our planet, and we need not take it for granted. It's going to take more worldly conversation on a subject matter called global innovation. Some people telling me that I'm insane, but all I'm saying, reverse global warming. I know we can reverse global.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. President Barack Obama went to the Chamber of Commerce on Monday, and his speech to business received mixed reviews from those outside. Jesse Russell has more.
The AFL-CIO responded by emailing a list of passages from his speech that they liked to Greg Sargent at the Washington Post. Among the parts the AFL-CIO liked was Obama's reminder to business that they have a responsibility to America, that they can't just worry about shareholders and the bottom line. The AFL also liked when Obama said that while he'll fight for changes in the tax codes so businesses can compete in the global market, benefits from those changes need to be shared with workers and not just used as bonuses or sat on as greater profits. Obama also said that while his administration will look at burdensome regulations, businesses need to acknowledge that some regulations are necessary safeguards and standards that protect the American people from harm or exploitation. Of course, it wasn't all roses and candy in the streets for Obama. Workers and progressives concerned about the perception that President Obama has been getting too cozy with business. Gathered outside, activist Ralph Nader had this to say to cameras capturing the protest.
So labor and workers put him in the White House and he turns his back on labor. But the corporations who have opposed him and want these corporatist Republicans in his place, he comes over and curtsies to him.
The Super Bowl's most valuable player is a union representative. Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers is a strong supporter of the Players Union, the National Football League Players Association. Rodgers says he stands behind the NFLPA and believes in the union as it fights to avoid an owner's lockout of players for next season. The Players Union blocked the lockout effort, is seeking to keep players on the field as owners try to take back some money and extend their season while threatening the lockout. The NFLPA's George Atala.
We still believe that a lockout is coming, unfortunately, and it's gotten to the point now where we as a union, as players, and as fans, frankly, need to do everything we can to prevent it.
45,000 airport security workers will get a limited right to collectively bargain. Transportation Security Administration Director John Pistole is using the power granted him by Congress to authorize it. Negotiations will be national rather than local or regional, and not everything will be negotiable. Pay, retirement benefits, job rules, discipline, and security issues will all be off the negotiating table. The airport security workers are scheduled to vote in March to choose between two unions for representation, the American Federation of Government Employees and the National Treasury Employees Union, or no union at all. About 13,000 airport security officers are members of the AFGE. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working for great public schools for every student. And by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We are here at the 2011 Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference. We're going to spend the next 2 hours, 45 minutes or so here at the conference, playing interviews that we did earlier today and talking to some folks here tonight. We're not going to be able to take phone calls tonight. So if you want to contact us, email is absolutely the best way. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do appreciate all the emails. But yeah, we've had a great day here at the conference talking to folks. And I'm excited about tomorrow is going to be another day. We're going to bring you some of the interviews from, people that we get to meet tomorrow. But, you know, it's good, Jake, to see that there's movement, in transforming our economy and moving us in a direction away from, the dirty old, fossil fuel, the dirty industries into something a little bit better as we move forward. So that's a good thing.
Well, if you look around, Rick, you'll see there's representatives here from unions. There's representatives here from business. There's representatives here from the government. The energy department had been here. There's also environmental groups, pretty eclectic group. And I knew fairly much about the movement, but I even found out some new things today. It's new and exciting, and actually it's the one area where I think it holds a lot of promise for creating a lot of jobs in the future, and our economy certainly needs it.
Well, we see today the Obama administration is calling on Congress to back a six-year, $53 billion investment in high-speed inner-city rail. Saying, look, hey, we need to go back to dreaming big. We need to reinvent the U.S. infrastructure. And, you know, I look at coming down here this morning. We got in the car early this morning to try and miss some of the traffic. Unfortunately, we didn't. But, you know, I look at that trip down here, and I say, you know, there is a desperate need for public transportation, if not just here across the country, because it's a crying shame. That there is not public transportation to get from Harrisburg to the nation's capital. If you want to go from Harrisburg to Washington, D.C., you've got to go through Philadelphia. And the Republicans don't want to fund Amtrak. And look, this $53 billion investment that the president wants, Republicans are going to fight tooth and nail. They call it a Soviet-style railroad system. You know, moving people around, getting them to and from certain places to work and the Soviet style. Now, understand, our vice president is a guy who very much believes in the Amtrak system. Why? He was able to take it to and from work every day, and not now, but when he was a senator, every day, back and forth. And he went home every day on that Amtrak train. To me, you know, I look at this, and we have absolutely got to start investing in this.
Well, you know, after sitting through that drive, I was actually driving, massive traffic jams. I mean, here we are on a major U.S. route, and we're going 25 miles an hour for, what, the last hour and a half. This reminds me of the healthcare issue in this way, Rick. There is no standing still. We're either going to go backwards or we're going to go forwards. We do nothing. The demands of the economy naturally are going to increase, so we either improve it or it's going to get worse and much, much worse.
Unlike traffic that was standing still. I mean, I look at this and I go, you know, my first thought was, how much money are we wasting? How much gasoline is being wasted just sitting in this, and nowhere to go. I mean, absolutely nowhere to go. And it's not like you can build more lanes. It's not like you can build bigger roads. We can't. A lot of areas maxed out. So you've got to think a little differently. You've got to think of some better ideas, which to me, again, I think the train idea is not a bad one.
Well, the good thing you learn here, Rick, a lot of times we blame big business for loss of jobs, and rightfully so. But we find out that there's a good number of businesses right now that are working in partnership with labor unions and some progressive groups, even environmental groups, to come up with ways to create jobs and improve the economy. And you mentioned about the Republicans in Congress. There have been some mostly Democratic governors throughout the United States that have been one step ahead of them, and they are going through with high-speed rail. They are going in for infrastructure.
Just not in Wisconsin or Ohio.
Right, and blue-green initiatives. And that's the future of this country. I mean, we can be ostriches, and we can stick our head in the sand, and a little bit like I like it when you talk about your children. Me, 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 me. Well, you know what? You can say, me, 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 I don't want to spend the money. That doesn't take away from the problem. And we're going to have to address this.
No, I can.
We're going to have a dim economic future.
I can make this a me, me, me argument. I don't want to sit in that traffic for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours a day. It is a me issue. It is a now issue. The fact that, and I, you know, I don't know how these folks do it every day, day in, day out. I, you know, I lived in Cleveland. It was kind of the same thing. We had backups. Every major city has this. So you would think, at some level,
this
invest in some reasonable transportation.
I looked at the signs, Rick, and it said 40 miles out. Now, this is, I think when we hit that, it might have been 5:30, quarter, 6 in the morning, early in the morning.
Yep.
I mean, it just, I've been to Washington a lot of times, but I think that was the worst.
No, that wasn't the worst.
Well, it was for me, coming in. Now, leaving, if you leave at 4 or 5 o'clock, it's even worse. But coming in at that hour, I was really surprised.
Remember that snowstorm took you 7 hours to get home?
Well, that was in 83, and the conditions were horrible. But
it was just a couple years ago.
I was...
83. You were the one who got...
Route 83, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I went Route 83.
I thought you meant back in
83. And it was bad because it was hilly and going up and down and... The cars were literally moving, Rick, 10 miles an hour, but that's another story. The point is, you know, we look at our reliance on oil, and it's no wonder. Look at the incalculable amounts of gas that we just waste just sitting in lines going 10 miles an hour.
To me, it's a national security issue as well.
Absolutely.
If you think about it.
Absolutely.
National security issue. Amtrak is proposing to spend $50 million on preliminary engineering and design for two new rail tunnels under the Hudson River to link New York and New Jersey. Democratic Senators Frank Lautenberg and Robert Menendez joined Amtrak officials in proposing what they're calling the Gateway Project. Amtrak says it will look for contributions from New Jersey, New York, and government agencies to cover the estimated $13.5 billion costs. The proposal comes months after Republican Governor Chris Christie killed plans for a new tunnel to relieve traffic congestion, citing concerns about New Jersey being on the hook for cost overruns. And, you know, again, you go back to this. Anybody who knows that area and has driven the Garden State Parkway or, you know, driven across the George Washington Bridge or gone through the Holland or Lincoln Tunnels or any of that stuff over in New York, New Jersey, you don't know. If you haven't done it, you don't know backup. You don't know gridlock. You don't know standing still.
And aren't there some real parallels between New Jersey and Pennsylvania? Kicking the can down the road, this is a way where he sees some money out there, and he's, aha, I can add that to the budget. It's a way of kicking the problem down the road and looking, at least in his perception, looking good politically. But I think it's going to come back to bite him.
Again, as we talk about Corridor 1 in our backyard, any of these rail projects, it takes vision, it takes leadership. And what I see out of someone like Christie, I don't see that leadership, I don't see that vision of what this country is going to look like in 10 years. I'm telling you right now, if we do nothing today, in 10 years, the problem just gets that much worse, and it's that much harder to deal with, and that much more costly. And that's the key. Inaction is going to kill us down the road. Now, understand, the Chinese, they've got a grand plan. And they're going full speed ahead. They're spending money like it's going out of style. In fact, our money. Because understand, we're buying all of their stuff. And they're holding boatloads of cash. So they're spending on infrastructure. Eventually, the idea, Jake, is to say, you know what? We don't need the U.S. anymore. Yeah. Goodbye.
And they don't have to worry about their teabaggers for a couple of reasons, first of all. I don't know that there are any, but if there would be any, they would just, you know, basically shut them up. But the sad part about it is, Rick, we are so polarized in this country that when this governor did that and took away thousands and thousands of good-paying jobs and just dramatically increased the cost of that project will be done. Might be 5-10 years down the road, but it will be done because it's going to be have to. You know, the teabaggers and those in the right, they cheered. Yeah. Well, I don't understand it. And this kind of political environment really adds to this, because some of these people in office now are afraid to do almost anything to give people the impression that they're spending too much money, even if it's short temporary debt that needs to be incurred, and you will get that investment in our infrastructure a hundredfold. Too many politicians are afraid to be called big-time spenders right now. And it's sad.
Well,
really
that,
sad.
It's that kind of fear that is going to cause us great pain and suffering in the years to come. And if we're not on the cutting edge, if we're not out there doing what has to be done and what we know has to be done, look, we can't continue down the same path. I go back to this all the time. I would love to see there be some rail service from where I live to Harrisburg. I would love to see something from Harrisburg to Washington, D.C., from Harrisburg to Pittsburgh. Start linking communities together. You know, and I go back to what my wife said. Now, my wife graduated from college back early 91, went backpacked across Europe with nothing more than a Euro pass. She jumped on the train. Boom, she went where she wanted to. Mm-hmm. Now, we're talking 20 years ago. 20 years ago, they had a far superior system than we have even today. What does that say about us?
Well, you know, you talked about train service, say, from Harrisburg, and you can multiply that by 10, 15 different cities. Given the situation right now, I would prefer to jump on a train, relax, maybe read a paper, sit around, maybe have a drink or eat a sandwich on the way down to Washington, pay whatever, reasonable, 50, 75, even 100 bucks, and avoid all this traffic, and guess what? Save all that gasoline. And I can guarantee you that those trains would be utilized.
Not to mention the $37 for parking.
Yeah.
Wow.
We forgot about that.
But yeah, we're here in Washington, D.C. at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference. This, I guess, is the third annual event, and it's a nice event. Tomorrow I'm going to focus a little bit on, hopefully, on business people who see the advantage of going green, who see the investment that they're putting into their business to be more fuel efficient, to be more energy conscious, seeing that return coming back. And multiplying. And I think that's going to be an interesting day tomorrow. We will be taking your phone calls tomorrow, because hopefully we will be back in the studio. But tonight we're here in Washington, D.C., live at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in D.C. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I think we're going to talk with Stuart Acuff, our good friend Stuart Acuff. Stick around.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Washington, D.C. still at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference 2011. I've had an opportunity to talk to a bunch of folks and about a bunch of things. You know, last time we were in D.C., the big snowstorm hit, and power for hundreds of thousands out for days. And I was amazed at the people that I had talked to during that time, how frequent D.C. outages are. Which leads me to the question, why aren't we doing anything to improve our grids? I remember my uncle in Cleveland a couple years back, the whole city shut down. In fact, that whole part of the country shut down. How do we upgrade that stuff? I've got Stuart Acuff, Chief of Staff of the Utility Workers Union, here to talk to us a little bit about that. Stuart, thanks for taking time for me, buddy.
Great. Great to be with you, Rick. Great to be on your show. I love your show.
I appreciate that.
Thank you for what you do for all of us.
You know, last time we were here in D.C., had the big snowstorm.
Yeah.
Almost everybody I talked to said they were going home to power outages.
Right.
Because evidently here in D.C., that's pretty frequent, pretty common.
It is way too frequent, and it's a result of cost cutting by the utility, which is the worst one at it, is the Maryland utility, Pepco. And when I say cost cutting, they're not trimming the trees like they should. They're not using the ratepayers' money like they should. They're not keeping the lines up to date like they should. And which means that last week we had 5 days of outages. So we have way too much outage, way too much of the time. The electricity grid is part of the nation's infrastructure.
Absolutely.
And it has to be addressed just like the rest of the nation's infrastructure. Here in the nation's capital city, in the last 3 years, we've had 4 water main breaks.
Wow.
That's a crumbling infrastructure.
Yep.
And that's exactly what's happening to our electricity infrastructure as well. This country needs to invest in this country. We need to invest in this country, in our workers, in increasing our productivity, and in creating a green energy economy.
Yeah, you look at the power grid, and I go back to when it was Cleveland, part of Pennsylvania, most of Ohio was out of power back several years back. It was like a week, 10 days almost,
right.
If I remember that
right.
How much have we done to fix that, or did they just use bubble gum and bob wire to put the thing back to
bubble gum and bob wire and a little bit of duct tape?
Nothing wrong with duct tape, but that's not how you run a country.
That's exactly right. We have seen way too many cases where utilities have asked for money from their regulators to do certain things, and have used the money to pay shareholders and $10, $12, $15 million, $20 million salaries to chief executive officers. We had a case.
Stuart, you got to admit, we need to have those big salaries because we can't possibly draw qualified people to be CEOs of these companies. Come on, you can admit that, right?
I think we can get qualified people for something less than $20 million. We had a case with a huge gas explosion in Southern California at a utility that we represent, where we represent the workers. The company had asked for $40 million from the Public Utilities Commission to fix a gas line, the very gas line that broke and exploded. They had, instead of fixing the gas line, they had put it into shareholders and executive pay.
Nice.
Now they've come back to the Public Utilities Commission and said, well, since we already spent it and since it still needs to be fixed, can you give us another $40 million? I mean, and that's why my union is now talking about public ownership of utilities. My president, Mike Langford, he and I just led a workshop on that.
You know, we were just talking about this on the drive down here. When I was a kid, Dennis Kucinich was mayor of Cleveland. And maybe you know the story. When he was mayor, they wanted to force him to sell Muni Light in Cleveland.
Right.
If he wouldn't sell it, they were going to put the city into bankruptcy.
Right.
And he stood his ground, said, screw you, we're not selling off a public asset. It's a public good. It's good for the taxpayers. It's good for the citizens. We're not doing it. They put the city into bankruptcy. The next election, they threw Dennis Kucinich out. But you know who ended up on the right side of that?
Who?
Dennis Kucinich.
Oh, yeah.
Because by keeping that public utility, They were able to save the taxpayers and the electric consumers millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars, absolutely. Plus, you know, public utilities, and when I say public utilities, I mean gas, electricity, water, wastewater. These are all human needs, and human needs should not be governed by the most crass greed in the world. And
especially when you're held hostage.
Especially when you're held hostage.
And that's what we
are. By a monopoly. That's right. That's exactly right.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Stuart Aikoff, Chief of Staff of the Utility Workers Union. You know, from being from Pennsylvania, the home of deregulation. And I still remember the ads that came on the radio going, you know, where do you think you are? God saying to you, where do you think you are? Pennsylvania? You don't have choice here in heaven, but you have choice in Pennsylvania. People found out what choice meant.
Right.
A 36% increase in their PP&L rates. That's what choice means.
Right.
They still don't have any choice over who's putting the power into their house, but they get to pay more.
Right.
And,
exactly.
And for the privilege of having choice, they get to pay 36%
right.
more.
Right. No, and of course what happened in California with Enron was just a total disaster. Led to the almost bankruptcy of the state. And of course it's funny that it's not funny. It's beyond ironic that these folks, who ran the country into the ditch, destroyed $2 trillion of this country's money, with phony financial, instruments.
Basically a three-card Monte game.
Three-card Monte game. Destroyed the economy, and are now saying, wait. You know, we can't spend any more money. I mean, you know, we can't put people back to work.
No,
we can't
Stuart.
Invest in America.
You're missing the message. We can't spend money on you.
Right.
we can spend money on the CEOs and on Wall Street and on bailing out the banks. Spend all that money
two
on
wars and occupations.
You know, Halliburton, you know, all
right,
of those.
Right.
We can spend all that money on them, but not for you.
Right. Exactly.
We got to get that message.
Are you or are all of your listeners either?
You know, the working people of this country who, again, are the ones who are going to have to tighten their belts and clean up this mess.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
All for what? So we can have 500 billionaires,
right?
Which is what we've gotten out of this whole mess.
Right. That's exactly right.
You and I, we get poor, and well, they're billionaires.
Right.
So who's the dumb one in all of this? But I go back to this whole deregulation thing. You know, this whole march towards taking what is public and turning it over to private for-profit interests, to me, not good for folks like you and me. But we're not the ones in charge now.
No, we're not the ones in charge.
And we should
but
be.
We still have a lot to say, and we should be saying it. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, privatization is just the giving away of public assets, frankly, for private gain. And privatization is a wolf in sheep's clothing. And back to the budget crisis that so many of our states and cities feel, they, you know, you've got policymakers who have trying to balance a budget with fewer tax revenues because, you know, you got now 15% fewer people working and American Water comes along like they did in Newark and says, we'll give you a big bunch of money if you'll let us have your water system. Well, you know, we stopped.
Understand.
It.
Now, before you go any further, who owns American Water Company?
Suez, the Suez Company.
And where is Suez Water
in
from?
Egypt.
Uh-huh.
That's
so
right.
An Egyptian company owns American Water.
That's
which
exactly.
is probably the biggest water supplier in the country.
It's one of the biggest. One of the biggest private ones. American and United are probably the two largest private water suppliers in the country.
And I know they're in our backyard.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're in everybody's backyard. They're all over America.
And a lot of people don't realize we've been privatizing our water supply, handed them the infrastructure, and they have done very little to upgrade it.
Or nothing. Very little or nothing to upgrade it. That's exactly right. And, you know, they get that resource forever. And one of the biggest fights coming in, the next fight over oil, I know I say oil like a southerner,
That's all right.
The next fight over oil is going to be the fight over water, because these guys are buying up water supplies everywhere.
Well, we've already seen it. I mean, you look at the Georgia, Florida area, where right. Lake Lanier, if I'm not mistaken, they're about ready to go to war already.
Right.
Between, what is it, Mississippi?
The Chattahoochee River.
Right in there.
Yeah, it's the Chattahoochee River, which provides water for Atlanta, but also provides water for Alabama cities and towns downstream as well. And they almost went to a civil war over the water in the Chattahoochee.
And as this, you know, and people don't like to talk about climate change. Global warming, look how cold it was in Texas. Hold on, this is climate change.
Right.
And as countries who are at the margin already
right.
feel the effects of this, water is going to be those things that people in the third world take arms over.
That's exactly right. No, that's exactly right. And that's why I say the next big fight over oil is going to be the fight over water. And because you're right, climate change is drying up our water supplies, particularly in arid places. It's making it more arid. And private corporations are buying up water supplies. And so we've got a double whammy going on us on water. The most essential.
You can't live without it.
Can't live without it. The most.
And you can't make it out of thin air.
And you can't make it out of thin air.
And, you know, the thing is, you know, I look at here in where we're at in Pennsylvania, they're doing a whole bunch of Marcellus shale drilling.
Mm-hmm.
And there's talk of polluting our water supply.
Right.
One of the largest freshwater supplies in the world. We're basically, at this point, no regulations to oversee how they're going to dispose of the waste, what's going to happen, what penalties they will face if they pollute our water. It seems we're going to be, again, reacting to another negative, just like the coal industry.
That's right. And your listeners need to understand that when we're talking about fracking and we're talking about polluting aquifers, we're not talking about polluting rivers or lakes. We're talking about polluting the water that is beneath us in yep. the earth, that provides all life on the earth. And we're talking about huge aquifers without which we can't sustain streams, rivers, or lakes. So this is a huge crisis. Yep.
You know, when I look at the privatization of our water supply, I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Take.
No.
Wait a minute, maybe it wasn't that. It was something else. But they were talking about, this movie I saw was talking about how Bechtel had gone in and bought up the water supply in Bolivia. And you couldn't even put a bucket out in your front yard without them fining you, because that's their water. It's proprietary.
I just heard about that movie.
It's not The Take, it's something else.
It's Even the Rain. Even the Rain. But people in Bolivia stood up, threw the government out, and eventually elected a progressive.
Right. And eventually threw Bechtel the hell out of
Dodge. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is what we're going to, I think at some point, going to have to do ourselves.
Right.
Because every step down the road, it seems we're moving to this handing what you and I own as the commons over to people who are only in it to profit from.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that, you know, that's, I mean, Rick, that's very important, and I hope you talk about that a lot more, because a lot of these differences aren't left and right. They're values. And when you say this is the commons, that refers to the common good.
Yep.
That's a very important part of fundamental human values and a very important part of religious teaching. Every religion, every ancient wisdom, every has held critically important the common good. And I like to say when I talk, you know, for 4,000 years, we've been all of human history, all of our wisdom, our sacred teachings have taught us that I'm your brother, you're my brother. You know, we have a responsibility to one another.
Until the 1980s,
until
when
about
it was
30
hooray
years
for me and screw you.
Right. Until about 30 years ago, when these snake oil salesmen came in and convinced us that it's all about me. It's got nothing to do with you. And, you know, Newt Gingrich, Dick Armey, and the whole crowd of them.
The whole Reagan Revolution.
The whole Reagan Revolution.
Hooray for me and the and the Hades with you.
That's
Stuart, it is great to see you. I wish to have you back again real soon. It's always great talking to you, man.
Thank you, Rick. It's always great talking to you. Congratulations on the new show and every night. And I can't wait till I'm driving through Pennsylvania and can turn you on.
There you go. Thanks
all
so
right,
much,
brother.
Stuart.
Thank
We're
going to
take a quick break right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. On the call.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Recently, I was among some 1,500 uninvited guests who descended on an exclusive closed-door political retreat held at a posh resort. How rude of us riffraff to intrude. However, America's always fragile democracy often requires confrontational rudeness. This secretive gathering of the rich was organized by the now infamous multi-billionaire Koch brothers, bringing together their shadowy network of far-right-wing moneyed elites and political operatives. For years, the Kochs have been working behind dozens of political front groups to intrude on America's democracy with their own schemes to establish a corporate plutocracy. Now that's really rude. So we decided to knock on the door of their resort hideaway and say, "We see you." But our purpose was not only to expose the Koch's cabal of billionaires, but also to focus media and public attention on the need to repeal the Supreme Court edict in last year's Citizen United case. The Supremes ruled that a corporation is a person entitled to wield greater political power than us actual human being-type persons. To do this, we need to pass a constitutional amendment that explicitly makes an obvious point. To be a person, you have to have a navel. Passing any amendment to our nation's basic governing document is difficult, but it can and must be done if America is even to pretend to be a government of and by the people. The good news is that Americans are up for it. A nationwide poll in January found that 4 out of 5 of our people support the passage of just such an amendment, including 68% of Republicans. This is Jim Hightower saying, 236 years ago, Paul Revere supposedly rallied the people's resistance to democratic repression with the cry, "The British are coming." Today, the rallying cry is, "The Kochs are coming." To join the resistance, go to www.freespeechforpeople.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
The Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C. They're partying it. They're partying across the hall. The U-Liners are in town. Joe U-Line and his labor band doing a rocking rendition of labor music. And you know, I wish we could find some more of that. And hopefully tomorrow we'll be able to sit down and have a minute or two with the legend himself. But until then, today's Borowitz report from Cairo, the Borowitz report says, in what Middle Eastern experts take as a sign that he's still very much in charge, today Egyptian state-run media declared President Hosni Mubarak sexiest man alive. To make sure that everyone in the country learned of his honor, Mr. Mubarak briefly turned on the Internet before switching it off again. Appearing on state-run TV to accept the sexiest man title, the Egyptian dictator adopted a conciliatory tone towards his political adversaries, saying, quote, "We may have our differences, but we can all agree that I am smoking hot." and a potentially hopeful sign, Mr. Mubarak did make cryptic references to a transition plan, indicating that it involved transferring $40 billion from Egypt to Switzerland. In Washington, a State Department spokesperson revealed that the U.S. was actively searching for a replacement for Mr. Mubarak, but we don't want to use the same headhunting firm that we used to find Hamid Karzai. Elsewhere, the NFL announced that next year's Super Bowl halftime show would feature Yoko Ono, a hyena, and two balloons that were rubbed together. So there you go, next year's halftime show. A couple of people I've talked to, not happy with the Black Eyed Peas, definitely not happy with the guy, remember Thing? Or was it Mr. It from the Addams Family, who was just all hair?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. It, who came out of the thing there, Slash. Thing, yeah. And I'm still trying to figure out what Usher was doing there with the baggy pants that made him look like he had a major accident. But, you know, you'll have that. I don't know if you saw this story, but in China, evidently they're making fake rice. They're no longer producing actual rice. They don't have to grow it anymore. And this is a country that's already got some food safety problems. And remember, one of our biggest trading partners. But here's the thing. This latest screw job the Chinese are pulling, what they're doing is they're, I can't believe it. They're mixing potatoes, sweet potatoes, and plastic. So the plastic, I guess, is formed into kind of a rice grain kind of kernel thing. This industrial synthetic resin is added to the mix, and it stays hard even after being cooked, they claim. Very Vietnam reported, a Chinese restaurant association official said that eating three bowls of this fake rice would be like eating one plastic bag. Due to the seriousness of the matter, he added that there would be an investigation of factories alleging the production of the rice. So look, you know, and this is one of these things that I keep talking about, folks. If they don't give a rat's behind about their people, what makes you think they care about us? I mean, if they don't care that their children, and remember this because, you know, like my wife goes nuts about this. The Chinese milk and infant formula, remember that? About 300,000 people were injured. They say at least six infants were killed in 2008 because of what they were doing with putting this melamine in the baby formula. You know, the same melamine they put in with the dog food that killed a whole bunch of people's pets here in the U.S. You remember the toothpaste that had antifreeze in it? I mean, go down the list of all the food products that come into this country. And you go, oh, yeah, they care about us. You know, they're even saying that this melamine is in their eggs. They've figured out how to put plastic in their eggs. It's just not those crummy Easter eggs that we crack open and get chocolate out of. They've figured out how to actually put the plastic in the eggs. And yet we see them as our number one trading partner. Think about that.
I mean, I guess, far be it for me to ask the common sense question. Why would you do that? It doesn't enhance the taste.
It enhances the production. I mean, you get more volume. More product, more sales, more profit, and it's cheap. It's not labor intensive like going out and actually having to harvest the rice. You make plastic, perfectly controllable, cost controllable. It's a beautiful thing.
Plastic is made quite simply for those who maybe don't know it.
It's made out of oil.
Chemicals.
It's made out of oil. petrochemicals make up plastic. Yes. You know what? Just go to Walmart and just eat a bag.
You might as well eat, you know, canned cancer. It's very carcinogenic. I mean, oh my, that's unbelievable. Of course, yeah, you know, American people, they buy apples, for God's sakes. Apples made in China. I mean, I this is probably the third time I told you this story. It flabbergasted me a couple months ago. A friend of mine bought some apples, and, you know, we happened to look at it. We told her, did you check the bag? They were made in China.
They were grown in China.
And nice. We have where I live, we have a plethora of apple orchards. And people are going to local stores and buying apples from China.
But they're not Chinese apples.
Woohoo!
But, I mean, you come back to this, and you look at what's going on with our trade policies. You look at our energy policies. And while we're here at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference, this is one of those issues, our trade policies with China, that really is front and center. Because everything we're talking about moving forward and being an energy independent country, you have to look to China to see how we're going to react. Personally, I think when they started building that wind farm in Texas, saying, oh, you know what? We're going to use all Chinese wind turbines. Why? Because the taxpayer gets a better bang for the buck. And it's almost like you have to hit your head against the wall a bunch of times to understand the logic. Okay, we're going to buy cheap, foreign-made wind turbines. We're going to create jobs in China. Using taxpayer money from here, although we got some, we don't have the technology, we don't have the industry, we don't have the employment base to support it. And, you know, I look across the country, and we're looking at adding more wind farms. In fact, four large swaths of ocean along the East Coast were identified as ripe for offshore wind farms and the development of such, and leases. The leases could be issued by the year's end, according to the Interior Department. The Energy Department said it will spend more than $50 million over the next 5 years to speed development of the wind farms and to help meet President Obama's goal of generating 80% of the nation's electricity from green energy by 2035. The Interior Department said the sites off the coasts were in Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and New Jersey. The funding will include money to develop technology to make wind power more affordable, according to Stephen Chu, the energy secretary. And my question is where are we going to get those turbines from? Where are those jobs going to be created? Are we going to allow it to be done in China? Yeah, I hope not. I hope at some point we begin to wake up and say, you know, we need to use the contracting process a little bit better. The procurement process a little smarter, maybe just a little bit.
Well, I remember Governor Rendell, no more than a couple of years ago. He thought that if we did it right, we could produce. I believe he said within 10 years, 10% just solely 10% of our energy, just by wind power. And if I remember correctly, I believe when Gamesa put those up, didn't they use American manufacturers at that time? Because the steelworkers were involved.
Yeah, they're in Fairless Hills in Pennsylvania. Yeah. They actually, you can see them sometimes driving down the highway. But the reality is
right off the turnpike.
What scares me is that it's cheaper to build them in China, ship them halfway across the world, put them up, than it is to build them right here and do it. And why is that? Oh, yeah. The Chinese government is handing tons of money into their industry, supporting their industry, which I'm not entirely against. Understand, you know, these countries, they play to win. And they have a manufacturing policy. Obviously, we don't. What we have is this bizarre idea of, oh, the invisible man. The invisible man with his invisible hand. He will guide the economy, and he will guide what is best for the country. And we're seeing what that has done. The hour sitting in traffic to get here to the nation's capital this morning. That's what it's done. Every time we sit in traffic, every time we're gridlocked getting to work in the morning, that's what it's done. That's the invisible hand at work. Anyway, but we're here at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Dr. David Madlin from the Center for American Progress are going to be talking about contracting and how do we use the procurement process. How do we better create jobs by using what the government already spends, the kind of money that we already spend. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time.
The Rick Smith Show.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. President Barack Obama went to the Chamber of Commerce on Monday, and his speech to business received mixed reviews from those outside. Jesse Russell has more.
The AFL-CIO responded by emailing a list of passages from his speech that they liked to Greg Sargent at the Washington Post. Among the parts the AFL-CIO liked was Obama's reminder to business that they have a responsibility to America, that they can't just worry about shareholders and the bottom line. The AFL also liked when Obama said that while he'll fight for changes in the tax codes so businesses can compete in the global market, benefits from those changes need to be shared with workers and not just used as bonuses or sat on as greater profits. Obama also said that while his administration will look at burdensome regulations, businesses need to acknowledge that some regulations are necessary safeguards and standards that protect the American people from harm or exploitation. Of course, it wasn't all roses and candy in the streets for Obama. Workers and progressives concerned about the perception that President Obama has been getting too cozy with business. Gathered outside, activist Ralph Nader had this to say to cameras capturing the protest.
So labor and workers put him in the White House and he turns his back on labor. But the corporations who have opposed him and want these corporatist Republicans in his place, he comes over and curtsies to him.
The Super Bowl's most valuable player is a union representative. Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers is a strong supporter of the Players Union, the National Football League Players Association. Rodgers says he stands behind the NFLPA and believes in the union as it fights to avoid an owner's lockout of players for next season. The Players Union blocked the lockout effort, is seeking to keep players on the field as owners try to take back some money and extend their season while threatening the lockout. The NFLPA's George Atala.
We still believe that a lockout is coming, unfortunately, and it's gotten to the point now where we as a union, as players, and as fans, frankly, need to do everything we can to prevent it.
45,000 airport security workers will get a limited right to collectively bargain. Transportation Security Administration Director John Pistole is using the power granted him by Congress to authorize it. Negotiations will be national rather than local or regional, and not everything will be negotiable. Pay, retirement benefits, job rules, discipline, and security issues will all be off the negotiating table. The airport security workers are scheduled to vote in March to choose between two unions for representation, the American Federation of Government Employees and the National Treasury Employees Union, or no union at all. About 13,000 airport security officers are members of the AFGE. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working for great public schools for every student, and by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C., the 2011 version of it. You know, for some time we've been advocating for the president to use the power of the federal government, create jobs, but not just jobs, decent-paying, family-sustaining jobs. Use that massive purchasing power that the federal government has for the president to push the kind of jobs that benefit workers, benefit taxpayers, and ultimately companies as well. How do we do that? That's why I've asked Dr. David Madlin, director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, to sit down with us. Dr. Madlin, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks very much for having me.
You know, I'm looking at all of the spending that we're doing and all of the stimulus which worked, even though the right is crazy saying it didn't. How can we continue to use the contracting process to raise wages, raise benefits, and ultimately pull our economy out of the dumps?
Well, you know, the power of the government as a business actor is really immense. You know, normally when people think about
the government to think about sort of regulations or that it's going to set a standard. For example, think of the minimum wage. That's for everyone. But when the government acts as a business, that means it purchases things or it has leases or grants. That's sort of acting as a business, and that power is tremendous. Every year the government spends $500 billion on contracts. And to give another idea of how big of scale we're talking about is nearly one in four workers in the entire United States economy works for a company that contracts with the federal government. So the ability to raise standards when the government purchases things is immense. You can really get into the private sector and raise standards broadly.
You know, I don't know if you've been seeing this, but in like Pennsylvania where we're at, Ohio, Missouri, New Hampshire, they're talking about pushing right-to-work laws. They're talking about doing away with prevailing wage laws, which kind of runs counter to what you're saying here.
Well, unfortunately, you're right. We're in basically the heart of the debate here is what kind of society we're going to have going forward. Is this going to be a middle-class society where people who work hard, play by the rules, can get ahead, or are we going to have a society where only those at the very top get ahead? Now, the right is pushing a whole series of efforts that basically ensure that working people have no power, like right to work, which really makes it hard for workers to join together in unions, or, for example, the standards when the government contracts, that those are going to create decent jobs. They're trying to get rid of those. We are in a fight. On the other hand, of course, we are also advancing our ideas. We got to beat back theirs, but even beating back theirs is not enough because the economy is not working well as it is. We need to go far further and advance our own ideas of how you raise standards as well.
You know, in this discussion about doing away with prevailing wage laws, we hear all the time that, oh, we could save 30% on contracting, on the cost of a building, which, you know, if you just sit down and do the math, it's not possible to save 30% because, as I understand, only a quarter of the cost are labor costs.
Yeah.
Well, so in order to save 30%, they'd have to work for free.
Well, that, you know, some people's dream might be that the workers would work for free, but that's what they're trying to get. But, you know, you're hitting an important issue. The other side throws out these basically totally inaccurate arguments that this is going to, you know, it costs jobs or it's going to cost government money. The thing is, we actually have almost 100 years of experience with these kind of this. We have Davis-Bacon that's been in existence nearly that long, and so lots of states have these kind of policies. So we have a whole long track record to study, and really interestingly, some states have canceled these laws and then gone back to them. So we have this track record, and when you study what actually happens when they cancel these Davis-Bacon or when they don't, contracting costs has not gone up at all. And that's because, not just because labor costs are a small piece of the total cost, but more importantly, you get what you pay for. You get much higher quality work. Turnover is significantly lower. So workers stay on the job. They're trained to do what they're doing. They produce better work. The government doesn't have to go back and redo things. Things last longer. Now, just to give a very small example, but of how serious the problem turnover can be when you have low wages that basically people don't want to stay at. For example, a study at the San Francisco airport where they passed a living wage law, which is like a Davis-Bacon, but it mandates that they pay a higher level wage. Turnover was annually 90% before they had this law.
Wow.
90%. So basically a whole new workforce every year. It's now down to, I think, about 15%. So radically reduced. People stay on the jobs. They get the training. They can do the right thing. And the study shows, you know, studies also show that turnover costs thousands, tens to $20,000 per employee because you've got to hire and train new workers. So just that's one example of the kind of savings you actually get from doing the job the right the first time and paying workers right.
Yeah, I never understood that, where you're going to try and pay the lowest possible wage, and you know it's going to cost you over and over and over again in training costs. But at some level, there's got to be a benefit there for these companies to keep doing this.
Well,
no.
The benefit for the company is some unfortunately, when there are no laws that provide standards, sometimes the government has to contract with the lowest bid. As we all know, if you're doing work on your house, you can get many bids. The lowest cost bid is not necessarily going to be the right bid for you. Sometimes it might be, but most of the times it's not going to be because you consider things like quality. Well, when you have these kind of standards, they ensure you get much better quality. Now, one other thing we didn't start talking about, but the other kind of costs that taxpayers bear when they go with low-road contractors is a hidden cost for paying things like Medicaid, food stamps, housing subsidies.
And those are also thousands and thousands of dollars per employee that ordinary taxpayers are basically subsidizing low-road companies. So, you know, it's really a silly business model for the government to be doing low-road business.
Well, let me ask you, are there models out there where you're not taking the lowest possible bid? I often think of the one astronaut, and his name doesn't pop into my head at this moment. He, you know, before taking off, he goes, you know, low bid got the contract here. Are there some formula where not only the lowest bid, but also track record and viability, those play into the contracting process?
Yes.
Because, you know, I don't want just the lowest bid. I want the company that's going to be around, has a track record, that kind of stuff. Because what worries me is I look at a lot of building projects where these guys make the lowest bid. They go in, they do a shoddy job, and they file bankruptcy and they're gone.
Well, you're hitting the nail right on the head. A good contracting system, and there are several out there, and many, many states, local governments, and the federal government try at some level to implement aspects of this. The good models, they do, a first thing they'll do is they screen out the bad actors that repeatedly violate the law. So you're not getting the companies that just can't even comply with a basic law. The second thing the good systems will do is they will have some basic standards for workers, like a Davis-Bacon or a prevailing wage or a minimum wage, so you know the workers are going to get decent pay. The other things they will do, as you started to talk about, is they will also incorporate a company's past performance, how well they've done, you know, so you know what the company has done. You know, did they do a good job last time? How long did it last? So the right system has all of these kinds of checks and balances. It's just that it's, and unfortunately, this is the kind of issue, well, it's, you know, I started off saying this is actually really big and important. You know, nearly one in four workers work for companies that contract for the government. But you start talking about government contracting, and I'll tell you, people's eyes glaze over. They don't want anything to do with this because they think it's sort of a small, narrow technical issue. It doesn't really affect them. But I hope this sort of conversation is getting at that it actually does affect you, and we have many tools to make the system work right.
Right. You know, and then bringing that back to this conference, if you would, how do we move forward with the green jobs that we're being told, you know, and we've been told this for a while, that this is going to be the middle class existence for the years to come. You know, we didn't heed the warnings when Carter was president. We didn't really listen to Jerry Brown when he ran as president, talking about rewiring the entire country. Are we going to take this call and move forward and create those jobs that they're talking about here at this conference?
Well, you know, that's the plan. In fact, you know, this conference brings together labor activists, environmental activists, government officials, elected politicians, that around this agenda that the future economy is a green economy, that's a good job economy, that we can build the future right here in the United States. Now, the small take that I had hosted a panel discussion today about how you use government contracting to fuel the green economy, and one of the key policies we're pushing, and there's a coalition of union, environmental organizations, good government groups, anti-poverty groups, they're pushing what we call the High Road Contracting Executive Order. The president has the authority, without going through Congress, to do major, major reforms in this place. And the first reform would kick out the bad actors. Only responsible companies get new contracts. BP, for example, kill workers repeatedly. Biggest oil spill in the nation's history, yet they continue to receive government contracts. Companies like that shouldn't be getting contracts.
That makes no sense at all.
Second thing we want to do is provide incentives for companies to go above that, treat their workforce well. So we want, just as a company's past performances, their management team, we also think you should consider the way they treat their workforce, the good wages and benefits.
Safety, and retention,
all of that stuff. And the better they do, the better likelihood they get. It's just one factor you would consider. So you are raising the bar. You set a floor with kicking out the worst actors, and then you provide incentives to raise the bar.
That sounds like great policy. What are the chances that this administration, who, I got to be honest, I haven't been thrilled with lately, what do you think the chances are of taking some of that advice that you're laying out?
I don't know. The most optimistic answer I can give is that the administration actually, in writing, said they were considering this proposal and were likely to do something very soon. Unfortunately, that was a year ago. So they've done nothing in the past year that would give me hope, other than they have already committed themselves to this policy in writing, so they should just follow what they've said they're going to do.
Well, just last week, the president was in Pennsylvania at Penn State talking about retrofitting buildings and doing some commercial changeovers, if you will, to make them more energy efficient using some technology at Penn State University. And I thought that was a step in the right direction. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Dr. David Madlin, director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Last question I've got for you. You know, the Super Bowl was just the other day. They're talking about the collective bargaining agreement, which I as I understand, the owners are going to throw the last year out. And possibly throwing the players out in the street as well?
Yeah, well, actually, last year, the owners opted out of the existing contracts, and that enables them this year, in a couple months, actually, they're going to be able to lock out the players. So that means potentially no season next year, you know, no draft, no free agency, nothing. That's, you know, a tragedy for all of the people whose lives depend upon, you know, the state working on the stadiums. So, you know, also just fans we enjoy watching that's potentially we're at risk. But more importantly, basically what's going on here is the same thing that's happening in the larger economy. Too many employers, owners in this case, are using what's happening in the larger economy, that the economy is weak and workers have very little power, to try to enforce their will and get concessions out of workers, even though the league, as everyone knows, is incredibly popular. Yep. Largest viewership ever for the last Super Bowl. Huge TV ratings. The league is doing well. We know that. Players should also do well when the league does well. That's what the current contract does. Unfortunately, the owners are trying to do a lot better for themselves without...
to do what a lot of companies across the country have done. They're doing well, but they see an opportunity to take a little bit back.
You're right on. You're right, and it's really sad, which is why I think normally you might think, okay, there's some millionaire players. Not every player is a millionaire, but a lot are. You might say that's disconnected from my life. It really is connected to your life because they're going through the same thing, where it's basically a power struggle between the regular workers and the owners. Who is going to win from this economy? We think both parties can win. That's actually the essence of what collective bargaining works well, that business does well, as do the workers.
Yep.
So really, we have a model for the larger economy right here with a football contract.
Do you really think they'd be that stupid with the all-time popularity of the sport to hold the fan base hostage over some money and this whole nonsense of two extra games?
We shall see. You know,
we'll see.
It's a bargaining ploy at one level, possibly. On the other hand, the owners have been very smart. You might say cagey. They have secured that they get the TV deal going forward. So they're protected. They're going to continue to get some money going forward.
Yep.
So that gives them a really strong bargaining hand, which I think they're really going to try to force. So I'm not so sure that... you know, it really could be a bad outcome for everyone here.
That's horrible. Dr. David Madlin, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much. I appreciate you coming over, taking time out of the conference. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Rick. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you out there. Oh, the good old union has come in here to
fill. We saw you all. that's always the question. Which side do you fall on? Do you fall on the side of the haves or the have-nots? I always go back to what my government teacher in high school said, you know, when asked about, you know, which party that you should affiliate with. And he said, look, at the end of the day, the Republicans are always going to identify with big business and the very, very wealthy. The Democrats are going to identify with larger government programs to help support the poor and the downtrodden. And you folks in the middle, you're going to pay for both of them. So your party affiliation is wherever you find yourself looking down the road where you may end up. Are you closer to living in the poverty class or the billionaire class? And I would argue the vast majority of us are much closer to living in the poverty class, as we've seen from this economic downturn, as we've seen millions of jobs disappear, vanish, a lot of them overseas. We have found ourselves looking down the barrel of poverty. And if you look at yesterday, Daryl Issa, he's the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee chairman. He's told business that Congress is finally listening. Congress is finally listening to the job creators. Because he released his responses to his, you know, his gimmicky, we're listening kind of thing. Last month he requested a whole bunch of businesses and trade groups and all these think tanks and all these people to, you know, to identify all those pesky regulations that, you know, that drive down, their profits and, you know, the job killing, tree hugging, hippie liberal regulations, you know, like clean air and clean water. Turns out, of the people who went on his website, to, you know, put their ideas in on how to get rid of those pesky tree-hugging happy liberal regulations. Turns out most of them were from Washington lobbyists who hate the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and there was plenty of hate left over for the Affordable Care Act and, of course, the Dodd-Frank financial reform law. So you know, the three things they hate the most, EPA, health care for those of us at the bottom, and stopping them from once again destroying our economy. So that's where the lobbyists have put their priorities. So he has this website, and he was soliciting responses, AmericanJobCreators.com, of which ISA said the project is an opportunity for private industry to put forth detailed and specific examples so that both the American people and policymakers can determine for themselves what actions can be taken to create jobs. So the question is, folks, who are the job creators? Who are the deciders? Who are the job creators? Of the people who responded to the ISA request, 106 of them were lobbying organizations. You know, people like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, you know, the American Petroleum Institute, Financial Services Roundtable, all those business groups, all those lobbying firms that their job is to twist representatives' arms to get the most favorable regulations. 47 businesses, American Express, Ford Motor Companies, and a bunch of small businesses, they responded. 26 individuals, 18 of them they could not identify. Along with the Heritage Foundation and George Mason's Mercatus Center. Now, understand that the job of a lobbyist is not to create jobs. It's not. His job, her job, whatever, the lobbyist's job is to twist government policy. Twist the arms, you know, tweak the law a little bit to benefit their paying client. You know, often, quite often, to the detriment of everybody else. Their competitors, to job creation, to any of that. So if you stop and you think about it for a second, if a lobbyist can get a loophole put into a bill, maybe to pay less taxes, maybe to have less EPA oversight, maybe to exempt themselves from the Health Care Act, that gives them a competitive advantage, the ability to take advantage of the situation. Now, it may not be good for you and me, it may not be good for the country, it may not be good for competition, it may not be good for any of that, except that country. Again, it's the me and me alone thing. It's good for me. And if they can get that done, it's mission accomplished. And it's money well worth being spent. Now, if you look at ICE's list, it's a joke because none of the 10 biggest publicly owned companies, the big employers, had anything to say in the survey as an individual company. What they did is they did it through their lobbyist firms. In fact, none of the top 30 job creators in the country did anything. So this, again, was a hit piece designed to destroy what little oversight's left while benefiting the big corporations. And, you know, come on, ICE is going to do that. He's a rich guy himself. And if you look at today's USA Today, Frederica Soten says special interest spending surges. Industries ranging from for-profit colleges and electric utilities to some high-tech companies are spending record sums on lobbying to combat federal efforts to tighten regulations on their practices. And they go through the couple of them. The Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. They have spent in the first 3 months, or in the last 3 months of last year, in the first 2 months here so far, almost $500,000. That's twice as much as they spent during all of 2009. And why are they doing that? Well, they're doing it because finally Congress is looking at these for-profit universities and going, they have a horrible completion rate. They have an amazingly large default rate that you and I end up paying for. And they're living off the back of the government. 80-90% of their funding comes from taxpayers. So these for-profit industries, this education mill, is taking money out of the public sector, putting it into the private pockets, and education isn't happening. Folks aren't getting degrees. We're not seeing the movement forward. Again, this for me is the model of where the vouchers in Pennsylvania is going to take us. For me, this is our future of Pennsylvania education. And you know what? The Republicans are happy with that. Very happy with that. According to CQ Moneyline, they have said that last year the lobbying dipped a little bit to $3.5 billion, down from $3.6 billion. I understand 2009, that was the big healthcare push. They spent a lot more on fighting the healthcare. But $3.5 billion on lobbying our representatives. How many of us have lobbyists? How many of us have people in Congress looking out for us? You know, you look at the electric utilities. Where were they? Where were our lobbyists when deregulation was happening? When our rates were going through the roof? They have spent nearly $135 million this past year. Why? And this is a 50% increase in their lobbying. Why? All the talk of climate change legislation. The EPA wanting to regulate emissions. Which they have the right to do. They want to fight that back so that they can get that advantage, that they can take advantage of that. And you look at Google. Google spent $5.2 million lobbying last year, a 30% increase over 2009. Why? Well, the government's considering the idea that maybe you should have some privacy in forbidding these companies from tracking your activities. That's why. And Facebook, the same thing. They spent $350,000 lobbying last year. And again, you know, to me, we should be doing away with these lobbyists. Our representatives should be answering to their people, not the corporate special interests. You know, that's not quite how the system was set up, Jake. And you know, I look at this and it was meant for Jake Long to go talk to his representative and say, this is in my interest. This is in our district's interest. Why someone from a big lobbying firm in D.C. is twisting your congressman's arm and we put up with it is beyond me.
Well, it's the corroding influence of money. And, you know, I had a good conversation with one of the people here from one of the organizations that's attending. And we got into a geopolitical discussion at the end of the day. We both agreed that we're not going to be able to effectuate much change. Or at the very least, we're not going to be able to effectuate the change that we should until we address the issue of money. Money, money, money. It is the 1,000-pound gorilla that we haven't we really haven't faced. And here's the problem. You're going to ask the very people who are benefiting, who are living a good life, many of them whom take jobs from these same lobbyists who represent corporations, who don't run for office anymore and then take jobs, fat, cushy jobs. How are you going to get those same people who are benefiting handsomely from changing the system? And therein lies a very difficult problem that we have in America right now in the political arena.
And thanks to our Supreme Court with the Citizens United case, now those lobbying firms can spend unlimited funds influencing our elections. Isn't that beautiful? But that's where we've ended up, and that's where we've gotten with all this.
You know, the House of Representatives, by design of the Founding Fathers, was the House of the People. It's become the House of the Corporate Interest, unfortunately.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bob Ball from the AFL-CIO. We're right back after this.
You could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We are here at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference in Washington, D.C., focusing on how do we move forward in the green economy. We have this great need and an enormous opportunity before us to reshape our national transportation policy. We really have a chance right now to write our policies, to write our priorities, and create millions of good jobs. And as Congress reconsiders its authorization bill for federal transportation spending, now's a good time to look at this stuff. That's why I've asked Bob Baugh, Executive Director of the AFL-CIO's Industrial Union Council, to sit down with us. Bob, I appreciate your time.
Glad to be here, Rick.
You know, I look at this conference and I ask everybody, what are your thoughts when you see this come together like this?
Well, there's a lot of people that care. There's a lot of people that have a vision about what we can do. I mean, I think one of the tricks in all of this is you got to have two things. One is the vision about that you can create good jobs, sustainable jobs. We can reinvent our economy. We can revitalize manufacturing. We can have clean energy. We can have new cleaner technologies. There's this huge moment of opportunity. There's also a political and economic reality that there's no guarantee these investments will be made in our economy. There's no guarantee that these will be good jobs. That's why we need to come together to be here, to make sure that we seize the moment and create good green jobs coming out of this.
And those jobs here.
Absolutely.
I look at the president, and, I've been down on the president the last couple of weeks. The fact that he appointed Jeffrey Eimelt as his job czar, if you will, and you look at their track record, mostly heading to China.
Yeah, I think this is Jeffrey Arnold's been good for a lot of quotes recently because he's actually said the right things about we've gone too far. We became a financial company, not a manufacturing thing. We need to invest more. And, we would agree with all those things. They're a big company. While the right hand may be doing something good, the left hand is doing something different. And I actually will give him credit for actually saying what is the right philosophy for firms in this country to invest in our economy and create good jobs here. They now got to deliver on those kinds of words.
Yeah, because I remember it wasn't too long ago where his vision was, and he said it often, China, 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 China.
No, it's true. And, the proof is in the pudding. Look at where the investments have been made. I mean, GE's financial corporation is actually housed in India. That's where they employ about 30,000 people. So they've pursued that, and all kinds of transnationals have pursued that.
our goal and what we're doing here and why we did this trade workshop today related to clean energy and why we're doing the transportation workshop tomorrow is about how do you invest in this economy? How do you use our trade laws to enforce the laws that should be in place so that we have an even playing field? But more just as importantly is we need to have a strategy. All our competitors do. Shame on us.
Well, we seem to follow this belief that the invisible man with the invisible hand will take care of everything.
Well, the invisible man is giving us the invisible finger for a long time. It's time to change that.
So let's talk about this because, you know, our infrastructure has been suffering for a generation at least.
Yeah.
It is crumbling under our feet. There doesn't seem to be this grand will to invest in it. I mean, we all talk. There's a lot of, you know, platitudes, a lot of discussion, but no real big movement.
No, I like to say we've been living on legacy, which is true, from stuff that was developed.
My grandparents' generation.
Gee, Rick, you're looking at me. That might be me.
You go back to the Eisenhower years.
No, you're right. You're right.
Eisenhower saw a great opportunity, and, you know, granted, he sold it as a military thing, but he invested in infrastructure.
No, that's absolutely true, and all countries do, and all countries are, and frankly, Europe, Asia, China in particular, they're investing and have put big money into the infrastructure for the 21st century, and we're living off the legacy of the 20th century. We can't compete with them unless we invest in the same way in ourselves. And infrastructure is broad. This is about buildings, it's about roads, it's about bridges, it's about highways, it's about mass transportation systems. Frankly, it's about our schools, and it's about our young people, and it's about our future generations. And we need to invest and think. In a way, this country needs to think about itself as a business and how we invest in ourselves to get a good return for our future on that. And we're not doing it. We don't even think of manufacturing in that context whatsoever. All these other countries do. They think about jobs and income, and I want manufacturing because it creates jobs and income to recycle those investments in our economy. We think about what's, at least some of these economists that say, oh, we should just send all the stuff overseas. It's good for the consumers. Well, you know, you're going to have consumers that can't afford to buy anything, and that's exactly what's happened to us.
Well, somebody talked about last night on the program. For the third month in a row, consumer borrowing is up. Credit card spending is up. Granted, wages are down, but credit card spending up, so the consumer is coming back. Because we have these little plastic things in our wallet that give us all this stuff.
Yeah, that's been tightened up a bit. So we've had a bit of that, but it's been sort of like we've been down so far that we're seeing a bit of an increase. We've got to grow, and we've got to grow in a sustainable way.
Right.
And we won't unless we have people that have decent jobs with incomes that can afford to pay for the stuff they purchase.
Well, let's talk about that because, you know, when you're talking about transportation, and we came down this morning. We came from Harrisburg to Washington here, and it was just an absolute nightmare. It is a crying shame. It's a crime that there isn't public transportation to get from Harrisburg, a state capital, to our nation's capital. It's a crime that you can't get from Pittsburgh to the nation's capital with mass transit. You got to go from Pittsburgh. If you want to use a rail, you got to go from Pittsburgh all the way to Philadelphia,
right,
and then back.
Right. No, we've let our mass transit infrastructure, our rail infrastructure for public use, go. We've invested in it to move goods, but not people. And we need a 21st century infrastructure and those kinds of things. I mean, I always like to pose it like this. We have a $5 trillion, at least, choice in front of us. And that's the level of expenditures, both for our infrastructure, roads and highway needs and those kinds of things, and our energy infrastructure, the two of them combined. We're talking $5, $6 trillion in the next couple decades. So the question before us is, will we make it here? We'll install the stuff, but will we make it here? And that's part of the part we are fighting for here. That's why we pushed in a stimulus bill and continuing Congress. If it's public procurement, use American vendors. That's what Buy American legislation is about. If we're going to provide tax incentives to firms for research and development, for clean energy production, connected to employment.
Absolutely.
You used to be able, 25 years ago, it was a safe assumption that if you invested money in R&D through our tax policies for R&D, for commercialization, we'd make it here. That is no longer a safe assumption. So we have to become much smarter and strategic and tactical in how we use our policies and connect them directly to employment.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And now moving back to why we're here at this conference, how is what we're talking about green? How is moving forward with transportation policies, how is that green?
Well, it's green in any number of ways because you can have transportation policies, as we've proposed in the Transportation Manufacturing Action Plan with Apollo Alliance, was a couple of things. It's support for high-speed rail. It's support for rail in general. again, for mass movement of people. It is support for cleaner buses and technology in that. Again, mass transportation systems, streetcars, and those kinds of things. It's for cleaner trucks. So all those things do a couple of things. One, it can help cut into our oil dependence from the Middle East and other countries. It means we will burn things cleaner. We will have cleaner cars and cleaner vehicles, and we'll move people in cleaner ways, which affects the climate, which affects greenhouse gases. Most importantly, we connected directly with doing these things also should be connected with making those technologies here. I mean, the simple fact is we're nowhere when it comes to high-speed rail compared to the rest of the world. Well, they have it. We don't.
Yep.
So now we have a choice. We're going to spend billions on that. Do we buy it from somebody else and have them ship it over here and just maybe assemble the final pieces? Or do we say, we've got some mass purchasing power and we've got a market here, and we're going to organize it in such a way to say that there's not going to be waivers. We're going to make the stuff here, and we want the best technology in the world, and we buy it from those countries. But we buy it and we make those things here. In fact, I give Secretary LaHood credit. He's going to speak here tomorrow. He pulled the industry together a year ago and basically said to him, we are not going to grant waivers for overseas production. We're going to make it here, but we've got time because it takes time to build this system out. I want to work with you to figure out how we develop the industry in the United States to get the job done. That's the way to think about it.
Absolutely. You know, I look here in Pennsylvania where I'm from. Erie, you've got the GE plant that's got 1,400 people laid off that make locomotives. You've got Maglev in Pittsburgh who makes the magnetic levitation trains that other countries are using. Why aren't we?
That's right.
There's a perfect opportunity here, especially during this economic downturn, during this crisis. You know, and I'm still saying it's a crisis because there are a lot of people who are still suffering, and there are a lot of folks who are still unemployed and underemployed.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was part of our discussion this morning about the economy. I did a little fact sheet on what has really happened in manufacturing in the last decade, and it's appalling. But what's really frightening, it affects our national security, in fact.
Absolutely.
We don't have a strong manufacturing base. We don't have a national defense base. Manufacturing base, that's what it comes down to. And people have started to step back and say, you know what? We really have gotten out of whack. Well, we need to get it back on track, and it won't happen because of osmosis or because it's a good idea. It's going to happen because you sit down and say, this is what we want as a nation. We align our tax policies to do it. We use our trade policies to do it. We target for technology around high-speed rail, around clean energy. We make the investments go there. We put the incentives in place. We stop the incentives for offshoring. I mean, it's changing a whole bunch of things. There's not one silver bullet. But in the end, these are the decisions that Germany made, France has made, that China has made. And I'm not going to fault China for having a strategy. Like I say, shame on us. We don't have them.
Yep.
I will go after them for all the things they do that are illegal in the world of trade in support of that.
Which is what I was going to ask you about. The steelworkers filed the trade case.
Right.
Again, I'm questioning why American businesses aren't pursuing this. The tire case, the same scenario, why American businesses, American governments aren't pursuing these cases. It's got to be the steelworkers who are doing this kind of stuff. How do we level the trade field, and how do we do it in a way that we benefit from this clean energy economy that seems to be sprouting up that the Chinese are really kicking our behinds on?
Well, I think you've hit it on the nail on the head. We got a couple things going here. I mean, it's like that old cartoon where we've met the enemy and he is us.
Right.
I mean, as a nation, we are conflicted. We got lots of good domestic manufacturers that are struggling to stay in business and make stuff here. And they're lined with labor on these trade issues. We have a bunch of transnational corporations that are, in fact, corporations without a country. They don't care. Their national interest is making it wherever they can take advantage and leverage it against us and access our own market, use it against us. You know, so that's part of the conflictual problem we have in government of being fighting against, in a way, ourselves, companies that were founded here that are engaged in this business. The fact is you can do this, and enforcing trade laws are part of it. But the other half of it is actually employing strategies and saying, the country is going to move here, we're going to invest here, we're going to make it easy for people to do business here, to make things here, and employ people in good jobs here. And along with that comes a couple of things. Standards say we want to create good jobs, that we own up to the fact that that's the kind of jobs we want to create. The rights of workers to form unions and represent themselves in their workplaces, because we know That's free market, actually free market economics.
Absolutely.
To be engaged in collective bargaining and make better wages and working conditions. That's what made this country great, and that's what we can do again.
Absolutely. That's what created the middle class in this country. Last question I have for you. You know, as we look at where we are right now, how do we find the will? Because, you know, what I'm looking at in Washington, I'm looking at a lot of people who are screaming, we need smaller. And when I hear smaller, I think ineffective, I think weak government. How do we get forward past that to get to where we're talking about where we want to go?
I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I think some of these are inescapable issues that we're going to have to deal with in the Washington environment. But in some respects, the environmental community, we as labor are stepping back and going, look, we did not pass national legislation around the climate stuff, and that came with a whole investment policy and all these things we're talking about, which is what drove us to say, here's how we can do this and create jobs. On the other hand, there are many things we can do at the state and local level that people become invested in. They get it, right? The states that did renewable energy standards, the states that have looked at what they call decoupling, which can encourage industrial cogeneration and conversion and retrofit of buildings and firms for more energy efficiency, building codes, all these things are in the hands of local people and state officials to do that make a difference. And people take ownership. And I would argue that the defeat of the ballot initiative in California, one of the few bright spots in this election, really comes because they finally got a culture that says, we want it cleaner, we want it greener, we want good jobs when we do it, and by God, we're not going to give it up. And they did it. And so taking this fight back to states is going to be part of the struggle of how you ultimately win a national battle as well. So I think we just dig in. We know this. It's going back to the roots. It's going back and working with the people. So they can touch it, they can smell it, they can feel it, they can feel it.
They can own it.
They can own it, right? And then it makes it easier, and they understand what you're trying to do. You connect the dots, help connect the dots with real stuff. So that matters. In the meantime, we will still fight a number of these issues here federally that will still be on the agenda one way or another. There is a big bill in the House and in the Senate around refinancing the highway funds, right? I mean, this whole the whole bill around financing for the Federal Aviation Administration, for the highway fund, that stuff is there. And there still can be discussion. And even the Chamber of Commerce has said they would support an increase in the gas tax to make sure there's adequate funds for infrastructure. It's one of the few things.
Yeah, well, no, very there was a huge gas.
This was a big deal. We we had an internal conversation. We said, we know we're in the same place. We should stand up and say it together. People will be shocked.
And I was. When the AFL-CIO stands with the GOP hit squad over there at the Chamber of Commerce, you know there is some bipartisanship there.
I will. Well, I'll give the Chamber credit. When Paul Ryan and other people came out with their plan, the Chamber did react very publicly saying, bull, we actually need to invest in this nation's infrastructure. It's dead serious. So I think there's some big fundamentals that we can fight around and for that are important to the future of the country. And according to what we heard this morning from Gene Sperling, you know, that's going to be all part of the president's budget, is that type of focus and emphasis.
Yeah, we saw him in Pennsylvania laying out his plan, and I think it's a step in the right direction. In the right direction. Bob Baugh, Executive Director of the AFL-CIO's Industrial Union Council, I appreciate you taking time for me.
You bet, Rick.
Look forward to having you back again real soon.
All right.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be here at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference 2011. We're right back after this.
CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross health insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of health care and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Your working class radio experience.
We're
Hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich and far red. Father, son, that cameo. Blue dental, head is vain.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show here in Washington, D.C. at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference. We will be here tonight, back in the studio tomorrow to take your calls. If you want to contact us, you can email rick@thericksmithshow.com. In fact, we encourage everyone to contact us. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, thoughts, comments, ideas, topics, all that stuff. Good. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com and download our podcasts. They're there for your entertainment and enjoyment. I was attempting to merge the words enjoy and entertainment together, and enjoyertainment. Big news out of Washington today. The House, in a procedural vote, has failed to extend the Patriot Act. The vote 277 to 148. Now understand, they've got to get two-thirds of the votes. They fell seven votes short of the two-thirds majority needed to pass the bill under the technicality there. 26 Republicans joined the Democrats, 122 Democrats, and saying, you know what, we need to really reconsider this Patriot Act. And this is one of those things, Jake, where I said, you know, the Tea Party, they're the ones who really came out and said no. They're the ones who said, you know, we've gone a little bit too far with this Patriot Act. Maybe we need to reel that back in.
And this is one of the issues that we can agree on. I personally resented it. I don't think most Americans really understood how much intrusion in the private lives of Americans that bill, that act allowed. The neocons way back, I'm talking back 98, were extolling the virtues of the Patriot Act, and they, you know, under the guise of 9/11, it was not only the Patriot Act, but some other things that they rammed through, because people were afraid to be labeled as soft on terror. Very few of them stood up, and this was one of them. I think this came out of a time when there was a lot of hysteria. And I'm glad to see, especially the teabaggers. I was going to wait and see before I judged them, but at least on this issue, they stood for the principles which they said they stood for when they came in office. So, you know, kudos to them.
Now, look, it's going to eventually pass. They're going to reauthorize it. This is just a first step victory to be able to say, you know what, there were 148 members of the House that realized that this is an intrusion and really a destructive force on the Constitution. Look, none of the things, and I've said this before, nothing in the Patriot Act is new. What it did is it streamlined the process, and it gave the ability of the FBI, and this is where I'm with some of the anti-government types, where I'm probably a little more libertarian in my view. I don't want to have this consolidation of power that can be really gotten around. I mean, you issue these letters of national security, and basically they can do whatever they want to do without, you know, without subpoenas, without oversight, without judges. Look, you know, they were always able to check your bank records. They were always able to check your medical records, your library records. They were always able to look in to come into your house and search things. They were always able to do that, but there was a process. And that meant going before a judge, saying this is what we're looking for, this is why, and the judge had to okay it. Now, look, the judge generally rubber-stamped and said, go ahead, but there was still a process. There was a trail to where you could then go back and say, look, you know, they abused their power. Mm-hmm. And that's what this is about. And as Dennis Kucinich said, the Patriot Act is a destructive undermining of the Constitution, and I agree.
It smacks of authoritarianism. I don't think most people realize that under the Patriot Act, when the government wants to go in your house, and they go before a judge. That and as if the government whips out the national security, that judge has no alternative but to issue that permit.
So H.R. 514 would give U.S. agents the ability to have roving surveillance of targets, collect business records and other tangible intelligence records to surveil solo operators who are not tied to specific groups, but they claim may pose a threat. Authorities say the thing's going to expire on February 28th, which means the House will eventually take this measure up, and a rule will be passed. This is just going to make the process slow down a little bit, and maybe put it into the eye of the public, because before we give up this kind of power, we should discuss it again. And what I like about this is that every couple of years we have to go back and revisit this. It's just not part of, you know, it's permanent law. There are sunset provisions. There are, hey, we need to reauthorize this. And again, I think down the road, as we move further and further from 9/11, I do think we will see some of this stuff allowed to sunset. But right after 9/11, if you remember when this was being debated, I remember going to a League of Women Voters a debate that they had. And what was interesting, the three people who had read the bill were against it. They had a panel of six people. The three people who, you know, said, I read every word of it, they were against it. The three people who were for it had read talking points. They hadn't actually read the entire bill, and they admitted that. But they were in favor of it on ideological terms. And that was one of the really, really bizarre things. And what I remember about that debate, I remember sitting back and watching the crowd of people who were very easily led down the path of, oh, we need to be more secure. Oh, we need these things to keep you safe. And now you fast forward 10 years, and you start looking at the porno scanners and the groping at the airports and taking your shoes off and you know, 3-ounce bottles of shampoo and all of the things that people are, quite frankly, fed up with for this illusion of security. And maybe, you know, as we move further away from 9/11, we will see it go away. Now, the White House supports a 3-year extension again. So, you know, in 3 more years, we will revisit this again. Because, again, I think this is going to pass. I think that's, I mean, 277 to 148, it's good to stop it on a procedural vote, and it's good to start talking about how we back away. But eventually, you do know it's going to pass.
Well, I guess my question is, maybe you know, I should know, but has that been taken to court on constitutional grounds? Or I would imagine maybe certain parts of it have?
Well, yeah, some of it has. You know, I remember the outcry over the library records.
Yes, I remember that. Some libraries refused to do it, to obey.
And a lot of them did. And a lot of them. And what was kind of interesting is, you know, the Bush administration did a pretty good job, and you have to give them credit for it, of kind of tap dancing around that. And not, you know, okay, well, we'll
kind of look the other way.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of interesting.
That was political.
Kind of interesting.
What is it when it comes to that law?
For the third straight year, Americans are paying less in federal taxes than they did under the Bush administration, which is kind of funny because you think about, and I've asked Tea Party people this often, you know, what does your T stand for? What is that? What's T stand for in your Tea Party? And it's taxed enough already. And we all know that. And to be honest, I'm right there with them. I do believe that we are taxed already enough. And we need to see some relief for you and me, the folks in the working class. But again, the third year in a row that American families have seen their taxes actually lower than it was under the Bush administration. You know, it's kind of funny, though, if you remember before the 2010 election, a large portion of people hadn't realized that their taxes actually went down and that 95% of the people in the country got tax cuts. Which, again, you know, I always question, don't you ever look at your pay stubs? Don't you see what's in front of you? And it's amazing.
No.
The reality is as the AP reported, Many taxpayers are seeing their bills drop under Obama because of more generous tax credits for college students, more generous tax credits for working families, home buyers, and the working poor. Again, those of us who are working for a living. We're right back after this.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
President Barack Obama went to the Chamber of Commerce on Monday, and his speech to business received mixed reviews from those outside. Jesse Russell has more.
The AFL-CIO responded by emailing a list of passages from his speech that they liked to Greg Sargent at the Washington Post. Among the parts the AFL-CIO liked was Obama's reminder to business that they have a responsibility to America, that they can't just worry about shareholders and the bottom line. The AFL also liked when Obama said that while he'll fight for changes in the tax codes so businesses can compete in the global market, benefits from those changes need to be shared with workers and not just used as bonuses or sat on as greater profits. Obama also said that while his administration will look at burdensome regulations, businesses need to acknowledge that some regulations are necessary safeguards and standards that protect the American people from harm or exploitation. Of course, it wasn't all roses and candy in the streets for Obama. Workers and progressives concerned about the perception that President Obama has been getting too cozy with business. Gathered outside, activist Ralph Nader had this to say to cameras capturing the protest.
So labor and workers put him in the White House and he turns his back on labor. But the corporations who have opposed him and want these corporatist Republicans in his place, he comes over and curtsies to them.
The Super Bowl's most valuable player is a union representative. Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers is a strong supporter of the Players Union, the National Football League Players Association. Rodgers says he stands behind the NFLPA and believes in the union as it fights to avoid an owner's lockout of players for next season. The Players Union blocked the lockout effort, is seeking to keep players on the field as owners try to take back some money and extend their season while threatening the lockout. The NFLPA's George Atala.
We still believe that a lockout is coming, unfortunately, and it's gotten to the point now where we as a union, as players, and as fans, frankly, need to do everything we can to prevent it.
45,000 airport security workers will get a limited right to collectively bargain. Transportation Security Administration Director John Pistole is using the power granted him by Congress to authorize it. Negotiations will be national rather than local or regional, and not everything will be negotiable. Pay, retirement benefits, job rules, discipline, and security issues will all be off the negotiating table. The airport security workers are scheduled to vote in March to choose between two unions for representation, the American Federation of Government Employees and the National Treasury Employees Union, or no union at all. About 13,000 airport security officers are members of the AFGE. This newscast was made possible in part by the National Education Association, the NEA, working for great public schools for every student. And by AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here at the 2011 Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C. You know, during the State of the Union address, the president talked about that Sputnik moment. How do we, that race, if you will, how do we win the clean energy race? Or can we? So I've asked Bracken Hedricks, he's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, to come sit down and talk a little bit about the big race. Bracken, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks so much for having me here, Rick.
You know, in looking at the The way this whole green energy movement has happened, I look at the Chinese, and I got to be honest, they are kicking our behinds.
Well, absolutely, and they have a plan over the next 5 to 10 years. They're significantly investing in rebuilding their entire infrastructure. They're going to be rebuilding buildings to be state-of-the-art, energy-efficient buildings. They're building high-speed rail, advanced electrical grids built around renewable energy resources. You know, a few years back, the argument was, you know, why should we do anything on climate change? Because the Chinese are building a power plant a week. Their energy demand is growing so rapidly. They understand that if they remain dependent on depletable resources, on polluting resources, their economy is not going to be sustainable. You know, we don't want to be the Chinese. The strength of the American economy is that we have, we have a democracy. We have free markets. We have the spirit of entrepreneurship. But they do have a plan for taking it on. And the American plan has really been sort of an ostrich politics of just hoping that things will turn around and not trying to systematically invest.
Well, it's been written by the invisible man with his invisible hand.
Absolutely. And this faith that markets alone will do the job is incredibly short-sighted, and it actually misses the point of how markets really work. You know, businesses make investment decisions based on where they think the economy is going, where they think the country is going. The fact that you trust free markets doesn't mean that you don't have leadership on fundamental public policy.
Absolutely.
Are we going to be a country that manufactures things, that produces things, that leads through innovation? Are we going to protect public health, protect worker safety? There's many, many places where policy is essential for the development of, you know, something like an electricity market. Electricity utilities have always been regulated because you don't want to have monopoly companies controlling things. You have to figure out what the pricing is. There's many, many ways where government has a very active hand in what our energy mix is, and it's only when it gets to these questions of, are we going to stop pollution? Are we going to build a diverse, robust, mix of fuels so we're not dependent on foreign states for, you know, imported energy? We're producing it here at home. There was a lot to be really excited about in what the president said, even when he wasn't talking about clean energy. He was, first of all, laying out the notion that clean energy is at the center of our national competitiveness, of how we invest, how we build. It's, that was a fundamental shift, this really framing our energy challenge as a Sputnik moment that's really going to drive our leadership or our failure to lead, and linking the whole climate and energy challenge to the sense that American leadership is really slipping away. We need presidential leadership. We need someone who's going to bring the nation together and start to organize our resources so that our investors, our small businesses, our manufacturing workers can all be part of these solutions.
Right.
So there's a couple pieces to that. It's actually a really pretty specific agenda. We spent the last bunch of years talking about, you know, climate legislation, cap-and-trade bills, all the stuff happening in Congress. We don't have to wait around for Congress to pass a comprehensive energy legislation. There's a lot of stuff we can do now to build an industry. The president talked about a clean energy standard. 80% of our energy from clean renewable sources, as well as a whole mix of stuff, clean coal, natural gas, nuclear, all these things play a part. If we want to build a clean energy industry, we need to make sure that within that we get a strong target for truly renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal. We need to make sure that energy efficiency is a part of that. But getting a national goal through a clean energy standard, huge step in the right direction. We just have to figure out how to build that.
Right. But in talking about that for a second, we've been talking about solar for 30-some years. I remember Jerry Brown talking about rewiring the country when he ran for president. All of these things we've been hearing for years.
Yeah.
Yet there hasn't been the will. And, I look at the current climate in Washington, and I don't know that there's the political will to do the kind of investing that I think is absolutely necessary.
It's interesting, though. The leadership of the United States has been incredibly solid, and I think we undersell how much we've actually achieved. Solar photovoltaic cells, the building block of solar energy, invented in the United States. They came out of our labs and our universities. The modern wind turbine, all sorts of advanced energy efficiency technology, new building materials. The problem has been that we're not building those markets. We're not making sure that our utility companies, that our energy system, actually makes a bet on deploying these technologies. And what's happening is that our foreign competitors are eating our lunch. You have China making a serious commitment to rebuild around clean energy. You have the German solar energy market is, you know, they have a solar exposure that's comparable to Maine or parts of Alaska. But they've got a world-leading industry, not because their solar potential is better, but because their market structure has made a commitment that they're going to bring in distributed energy, they're going to give people a fixed price, so you know if you build the panel, you'll be able to sell the energy back to the grid. And you know, people want to do it if they're given an opportunity. I was talking to a really interesting conversation yesterday with a financial analyst who's looking at why renewable energy companies are building their plants in China. And, you know, we're used to thinking of, oh, low-cost labor, right? American labor costs are too high, you go to China.
I would take massive subsidies from the Chinese government.
Well, and it's not, it's actually low-cost capital. The labor costs are really small for running a you know, large-scale renewable plant. But the access to cheap capital, and what the Chinese are sitting on huge pots of cash because of all of the trade imbalances.
Right.
And they got to put that money somewhere, and they're using it to drive down the cost of investment into these plants. And a really interesting conversation happened here in the opening plenary at Good Jobs, Green Jobs, talking about what happens when you let manufacturing slip away. We're used to thinking, oh, the American economy leads through R&D, through being on the cutting edge of technology. We aren't a low-cost producer. We're a high-value-added producer. We're an innovation-led economy. If we let our manufacturing base migrate to China, what happens is that over time, the intellectual capital moves to be close to the source of production. The research moves to be close to those universities that are tied into that supply chain.
Yep.
That's how we built our economy. It was through a conversation between commercial scale production and the next iterative generation of how you keep moving these technologies forward. So the United States is still at the leading edge of economics, the leading edge of the production of these new technologies, the leading edge of research, but we're going to lose that unless we make that commitment. So the president talked about low-cost finance with a green bank. He's been talking about building markets through a clean energy standard. He's been talking about helping move all of the tools that exist within the executive branch. He announced the other day the Small Business Administration making low-cost loans available to small and mid-sized companies that want to do energy efficiency retrofits.
Right.
That's the kind of thing. You can roll that out in every city around this country and start creating real markets for the skills of workers, real demand for small businesses to actually move into new, you know, new areas of their business growth. Green jobs kind of sound like a new thing, right? It's the sort of the jetpack, gee whiz technology. In reality, it's about taking existing HVAC contractors and giving them a whole new line of work as people put in the most state-of-the-art energy-efficient air conditioning systems. It's about taking building service workers and giving them, you know, the tools to be the frontline energy service workers as offices and factories are upgraded. It's jobs for boilermakers, for sheet metal workers, for steel workers, across the entire foundation of our economy. A green job strategy for economic development means more jobs, better jobs, and a stronger economy over the long term that's actually positioned to compete, which brings us back to the Sputnik moment. This really is the moment of truth for the American economy, for our competitiveness, and for our ability to fight and win. The president said we can do it. It remains to be seen whether Congress starts to rally around these particular things like a green bank, a clean energy standard, or new energy efficiency policies. But there's real opportunity for bipartisan consensus, for real action, and for leadership on the ground in our communities.
Yeah, because if we don't do it, big trouble down the line. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Bracken Hendricks, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is the website. You know, the president was in Pennsylvania recently rolling out that very program that you're talking about, retrofitting buildings. And I've been calling for the longest time, because we've had the technology for the longest time, to make buildings energy independent, to make homes energy independent. I would love to see building codes that encourage that kind of stuff. But again, it comes back down to this will. Not can we do it, but will we do it?
Right. And that's another place where we got this myth about the free market and the magic of the invisible hand of the marketplace. The economics of energy efficiency in a building are, you know, they're just undeniable. You know, you get a payback for a lot of, like, lighting changes, advanced motors and pumps, you know, within a year. and then they start returning a return on that investment year over year. For some systems, for certain things, you know, maybe it's 2-3 year investment. For some of the really exciting technology, maybe it's even a 10-year payback, but it pays for itself within the life of that
investment.
The reason we're not doing it is because people who are making those investments, they don't have the right incentives. The folks aren't seeing the return when they sell the building because there's like breakdowns in the real estate market. It's too difficult to finance these investments even though they would pay for themselves because the real risk and return aren't understood in the capital markets. There's all these places where our markets are broken down, but things like a building code can just make it common practice.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, Bracken. And that's one of the things I've been talking about for quite some time, making those codes mandatory, and it just becomes as a matter of course. Bracken Hendricks, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Right back from the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make history happen.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We are here in the Wardman Marriott in Washington, D.C., where evidently the CPAC convention is going to be happening in the coming days. What I find interesting is our former senator, Tricky Ricky Santorum, said today that Sarah Palin, who has decided to skip CPAC, the conservative Political Action Committee, she decided to skip it. She must have other business opportunities. He said, quote, "I have a feeling that she has some demands on her time, and a lot of them have a financial benefit attached to them," adding that Palin has other business opportunities. And basically he's saying, look, you know, she's out there making a whole boatload of money on those bad speeches that she writes on her hand. Maybe a little jealousy, maybe. It's been estimated that our quitter queen, the former quitter Alaska governor, since 2008 has collected some $30 million in fees per year. So, you know, like when I said from the beginning, when she gave that whole song and dance about, oh, I care about the state. Oh, I'm quitting so that the state can go forward. No, she quit for $30 million a year. Now, Santorum, who they say is a father of seven, good Catholic, says that her other responsibilities are raising her children that he doesn't have. He said, quote, "I don't live in Alaska, and I'm not the mother of all these kids, and I don't have other responsibilities that she has," kind of softening the blow. But here's the thing. Understand that when Tricky Ricky gets down to it, he is going to attack her at every front. And you know what's kind of odd? I'm almost going to try. There's part of me that feels I may actually have to defend her a little bit against Tricky Ricky's attacks. Again, the Republican, the GOP presidential field is filling up quickly. You got Sanitarium there, the crazy woman Michelle Bachmann, Newty Newt, Mitt Romney, Mitch Daniels, Tim Pawlenty, Rick Perry, Haley Barbour, John Bolton, and a whole bunch of others. They will be at the CPAC gathering of Insaniacs. I would love to come down here for that. I wish they'd invite me. Anyway, and speaking of Rick Santorum, I found something that, you know, because Rick, he loves to talk about the Catholic Church and his, you know, his faith, and I found something for Tricky Ricky that could help him in his everyday life. Evidently, through iTunes for $1.99, you can get an app that will basically wipe your sins clean. It's the Confession, a Roman Catholic app available through iTunes for $1.99. So you could basically go to confession anytime. You can confess your sins anytime. Now, understand, this is not going to replace traditional confession. You still have to go into the box and bless me, Father, for I've sinned, and he will give you your absolution. You'll go do the abby-gobbies there. And and you'll be then granted absolution. That the app isn't going to do this, but you know, a spokesman for the company that designed it said their desire is to invite Catholics to engage in their faith through digital technology. So basically, they're trying to create an environment where people maybe you're going to get people who are sorry for their sins, and maybe they won't sin again, and maybe it's a good thing.
Well, it sounds like, you know, if you're a big sinner, Rick, you're getting a good deal there.
I sin every day. And speaking of sinners, you know, the hyper-evangelical Christine O'Donnell evidently is forming a new pack. Because what she wants to do is she wants to go after that liberal-controlled GOP establishment. And George Soros, of course, and other liberal-funded groups. Because, you know, here's the thing. Christine Pack can investigate and counter attacks from left-wing groups, many funded with $1 million or more from billionaire leftist George Soros, she wrote in her email. I love the part, can investigate. See, that leaves it open, leaves it really wide open. We could, but I would rather use the money to spend on rent and clothing and living expenses than to actually do what I'm telling you I'm going to do. And this, understand, this is a ploy to get crazy conservatives like, you know, the ones she likes to exploit, to open their wallet and hand out money. That's what this is about. You got to give her credit. Here's a woman who's never had a job, and yet, she's been able to make a very decent living. And also in this bizarre twisted email, the one that says there's this great liberal media out there out to get her, she claims that the White House marked her as number one opponent. You know, so she was enemy number one, and that her bad campaign with the second worst ad in politics behind the Honorado holding his name sign, the I'm not a witch ad, evidently that sent shockwaves throughout the nation. No, what it did is it said, you know what, honey, maybe they did figure out how to put a mouse's brain inside a human being. Maybe.
There for a while, if you remember, Rick, to remember good times, it was her and Sharon Engel. They were neck and neck when it came to saying the stupidest things on a campaign trail.
I miss them.
I mean, they would one-up them, you know, they would say something and I would say, well, no, you can't say anything worse than that. And yeah, they did. The next week, and then they said something dumber than what they said before.
But I mean, I look at O'Donnell, and I'm, you know, again, I'm waiting for the attorneys general there in the state of Delaware to make
their investigation
decision,
yeah.
Where this is going to go. Because I got to be honest, I'm thinking about it. Hey, running for office, going around shaking hands, kissing babies, you know, doing that kind of stuff. That doesn't seem like hard work.
Look,
if I can get people to keep giving me money, and I can pay my mortgage, and I can, you know, I can pay my car payments, and I can go out to dinner, and I can do all those things on people giving me money. Hey, this might be good for the unemployment. You might get a whole bunch of people running for races that are never going to win and don't want to win. They just want to ride the train.
Well, we have a lot of fun with her. I mean, and she's easy to make fun of because she makes fun of herself. But the accusations against her, make no mistake, are serious. She violated campaign finance laws.
Allegedly.
Well, allegedly. allegedly. And if she's found guilty, she faces some fairly stiff penalties, not to mention probably the end of her what political career she has. She probably ended it if she's found guilty.
So basically, you know, you got to give her credit, and I do. I give her credit on this. Some of her advisors have got to be giving her some good advice because I don't think she can think this up on her own. What they're doing is they're projecting. They're out there on the offense, saying, "Oh, this is an attack by the White House. This is an attack by liberal groups. They're coming after me. All of this criminal investigation, it's all made up, and we're going to fight back and we're going to go after them." But I go back to that word, can. Christine Pack can investigate. Not that we will, but we can if we so choose. And if we have enough money so I can pay my rent and buy groceries and do all the things that I need, buy new clothes, because, you know, I need new clothes. If I can make more money, then, you know, maybe. Maybe if I could make the $30 million that the quitter governor from Alaska made, maybe then we would do some of that looking into. Maybe, just maybe.
You know, that when you throw those numbers out, Rick. I doubt seriously if our quitter governor is going to give that kind of money up. I don't think she wants to run.
Of course she doesn't.
She just loves the limelight and loves the money.
And speaking of our former quitter, evidently, and again, this is another reason. Honestly, you know, it's fun to poke. You know, it's fun to poke a little bit of fun at people. But the reality is this woman wanted to be vice president. She could have been vice president. A heartbeat away from the presidency. So last week we talked about, you know, Palin Inc. Talked about the fact that her and Bristol, they they basically wanted to trademark their names. So they had these applications for trademarks, and they were rejected by the federal government because, and this is the AP reporting this, they forgot to sign the form. And I'm going, really? You forgot to sign the form? And you want to run for government. You want to lead this country when you can't do something as simple as signing the form. You know, I'm all in favor of Palin Incorporated. Good luck. But when you can't fill out a simple form, with $30 million a year in income, we've got some serious, serious questions about her competency. And speaking of competency, and, you know, what gets me is we can go through story after story after story of the Republicans breaking rules and breaking the law and not being held accountable because their minion base doesn't care. All they're focused on, oh, it's those liberals that are everywhere. And, you know, I would really hate to live in that world where someone is, where you're constantly under attack, where the evil liberals are everywhere. You're surrounded by them. You know, you're behind enemy lines. And are there that many liberals in this country?
Well,
the answer is no.
She's not the only one. I mean, your crazy girlfriend, Michelle. What crazy thing has she said this week, Rick?
Well, you know what, she hasn't said anything.
Is she still this great historian on the history of slavery?
I love that whole. They tried to say CNN was setting her up with that camera thing. It turns out it was a Fox cameraman who did it. I find that hysterical. Because she didn't know which camera to look into, and they set it up. They set it up that way. It wasn't, you know, you could say a lot of things about her, but I'm sure she was told where to look, and she looked where she was supposed to. But she didn't bother to look in the big camera. Maybe a couple of people were watching on the internet camera that she was looking at that was set up right. But the CNN camera that was actually a Fox camera that was fed to CNN, which, again, we a whole discussion for another day about how they have destroyed the news-making in this country and how they've pooled resources to make workers work harder and longer for less. That's a whole other discussion, but kind of there, too. But Michelle's back in the news. According to the Federal Elections Commission, they've asked Michelle Bachmann for more information about her campaign finance reports. This according to Roll Call. That says the Minnesota Republican who is thinking about running for president in 2012 won the most expensive House race in the country. Now, you know, Bachmann, she's the chairwoman of the T. Twizzler caucus. She raised more than $13.5 million in a house race.
Mm.
Roll call, quoting an FEC letter, notes that Bachman failed to itemize about $1.5 million in individual contributions. So, you know, where'd that go? The law requires details for any donation more than $200, and they failed to do that. She also may have filed the report last-minute contribution, so they don't know if that $13.5 million is all of it. Maybe at the last minute, a whole bunch of money came in that, again, they didn't report. Andy Parrish, Bachman's campaign person, said it's not uncommon for the FEC to ask for more information. He said the campaign had more than 100,000 donors demonstrating a broad base of support, but also required a large record-keeping operation. The campaign will continue to ensure that the act is in full compliance. Bachman has until Thursday, and I'm waiting with bated breath because, to be honest, you know, maybe I'm not saying she needs the money. They're very wealthy on their own. But here again, it's one of those, this is a woman who wants to be president. These are people who can't follow simple rules and hire competent people. So, you know, again, it takes you back. How many House races, how many Senate races, how many state legislator races, how many of these races go every year, yet you only find a handful. Christine O'Donnell, Michelle Bachman, Palin Incorporated. Kind of makes you wonder. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Mark Norberg. Stick around. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Don't have a phone? Email Rick. Rick@therickssmithshow.com. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
There's a thundercloud exploding, and I'm free at last. Like Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. Like our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. Like the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women, standing up and standing strong. Like the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. We're here at the 2011 Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C. You know, talking about how do we create the jobs for the new economy? How do we use, how do we reuse things? How do we use things that we've already made, recycle them, create energy? How do we do that stuff? I've got Mark Norberg here. He's assistant to the president for the Sheet Workers International Association. Mark, thanks for taking time for me.
No problem.
You know, in looking at some of the things that are going on here at the conference, How does recycling fit into all of this?
Well, I'm here at the conference mainly to speak about recycled energy. And the basic concept there is that through our daily life, our houses, where we work, how our power is generated, a lot of heat is wasted. In the industrial process, most industries waste 67% of the heat they generate where they could recycle that. Residences, typically waste 40% of the heat that right. They generate. It's thought a lot of experts agree that in the residential realm, were we to make a modest investment in saving the heat that is wasted in housing, we could save $400 billion a year in this country.
Wow.
In commercial or institutional settings, roughly the same amount of money.
Yeah, the president was just in Pennsylvania not too long, a couple of days ago, talking at Penn State University about just this very thing, mm-hmm. Rolling out an initiative to start on commercial buildings, retrofitting them, changing building codes, doing a lot of that stuff to try and save some of the energy that you're talking about.
Right, right. And, we've identified the need. We see the need to save it, and we're at a unique time in the world here where we have all the ability to meet that need. We have the trained workforce with 20% of them being idle right now. We have the training capacity to train those people to do this work, and as well as new people should the need arise to train them to do this type of work. There's a need. We have the capability. We just have to have
the will.
We have to have the will.
And in the State of the Union, the president called for that Sputnik moment, this generation's Manhattan Project, whatever you want to call it. But the clarion call to, hey, we got to do something, we got to do it now, because the country that leads in this century in energy is the one that's going to make out the best.
Exactly. We're losing a lot of our national competitive advantage by wasting energy. The longer we go, the greater the gap in that competitive advantage, and the time to act is now.
Absolutely. Let's talk about some of the things that you're seeing as assistant to the president of the Sheet Metal Workers International Association. What type of things are you seeing moving in this direction of what we're talking about?
Well, our local unions are very proactive in attacking this, and we have several unions that are really taking the bull by the horns. The one that leaps to mind primarily is our local in Philadelphia, who's, they're looking at, that's a great pharmaceutical corridor through Philadelphia, New Jersey, and with millions of lab hoods where the chemists make the solutions and test things. And, they've come up with ways to save enormous amount of energy with each hood, and they're pursuing the pharmaceutical industry, letting them know about this, and as an international union, it's our job to share that information with the local unions in similar areas like the San Francisco area and so forth. So we're constantly looking at this edge and the edges that our local unions are developing and disseminating the information so other locals can do the same.
Right. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference here in Washington, D.C., the 2011 version of it. I'm here with Mark Norberg, Assistant to the President for the Sheet Workers International Association. One of the things that I tout about sheet metal workers and a lot of the building trades folks is the training programs.
Yep.
And I'm sure you guys are doing an awful lot of training based on hopefully what's coming in the green revolution, if you will. Can you talk a little bit about what you guys are working on?
Yeah, absolutely. We have the capacity. We have 160 training centers in the United States and Canada. These training centers are managed by joint labor-managed apprentice committees and training committees. And they look at the market. They look at what's on the horizon, and they train to task. I don't know of any other international union that expends as much money and time on training. All of our instructors are sheet metal workers, almost all of them on their own have attained a Bachelor of Arts degrees in education. And, you know, we're like the bow that's an arrow with the our arm fully extended, ready to release the arrow. We were ready to release our training, the people with the skills that we've already trained, and we have capacity to train thousands more people. You know, we're busy identifying the market, refining what we need to do as far as training, and we can turn around on a dime.
Yeah, and talking about that, you know, you look at these training programs, and I encourage young people to get involved in these, because that's going to be the it's going to be the jobs of the future. Talk to the young people a second about the training programs that you see coming up in the coming years.
Yeah. Well, we're technology immersed in the sheet metal workers. We've developed our own CAD design system, own building information management system that we're training all our journeymen and apprentices with. We do building retrofit analysis commissioning to make sure that every possible BTU and watt of energy is saved. And, you know, if you're a technically minded young person, you know, take a look at the sheet metal workers. You know, the skills that you will learn will stand you like they've stood me for a lifetime. We have constant journeyman upgrade training based upon the market and the economy, open to all our members, whether they're journeymen or production workers or sheet metal workers. For a young person, I don't know of anything better. You know, I'm a little prejudiced. You know, I would say get into the sheet metal trade. But if you can't, you know, just settle for one of the other ones, and you'll receive the equivalent of an associate's degree in college by the time you're done with your apprenticeship. You'll have none of the debt associated with going to school.
Yeah, because while you're going, you actually get paid to go.
Absolutely.
And you're paid to learn, and it's really something that I will have my children look into as they grow older. Here's the thing, you know, in looking at this, in going back through your years in the Sheet Metal Workers Association, how have things changed? I mean, you're talking about high-tech stuff today. We're not just talking about tin knockers anymore.
Sure.
This is high-tech stuff.
Right. You know, when I started, it was very labor intensive. You were only as good as how strong your body was, and now it's a thinking man's game. And computer literacy is driven down, and computer skills are driven down to the lowest apprentice. You know, where the job requirements, you know, knowing the safety regulations, how to look them up online. You know, being able to read a complicated set of specs and plans and much of those online as well as our computer, design and building information management programs, it's really changed, and culturally it's changed too. You know, when I started, it was a family-run operation, and you could call it a white country club. Now we totally embrace diversity. It's made us a much richer organization, and we've changed with the times. It's light years different from when I started.
Yeah, I can imagine. Last question I've got for you. As we look to the future, we know what has to be done. We know we need this job training. We know we need these green jobs. How do we get there from here? I mean, I go back and I think of all of the during the Carter years, pushing towards wind and solar. I remember Jerry Brown running for president saying we need to rewire the entire country to save electricity. All of these calls have gone unanswered throughout the years. Why is this time any different?
Well, I think our back's against the wall. I mean, you only have to, take a look at the Super Bowl here with the global warming and the cold weather in Dallas, Texas at a time of year they're never cold, or the polar ice caps. We have to do something about our environment, and we have to do it now. And whether it's changing our tax structure and the way we let companies do business in the United States or whatever, it is something that has to change now before, you know, we waste our planet.
I agree. Mark Norberg, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Assistant to the President of the Sheet Metal Workers International Association. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Of a brand new world economist. I don't believe them, I won't despair. They are a group and they're coming back to stay. So the same can't climb back up to 50% once again, my friend.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Got a tweet that said instead of Christine Pack, maybe we should call it the Whack Pack. And, you know, there's some truth in that. When you look at Christine O'Donnell and some of the nonsense that's going on around that campaign, you know, at some point you just have to wake up and say, cuckoo, cuckoo. And I'm hoping there's some jail time in her future. Speaking of jail time in someone's future, I'm kind of hoping that as Mubarak is pushed out, maybe there's some jail time. Maybe there's some way recoup some of the reportedly $70 billion that he may be worth. They're saying, you know, his family has put a whole bunch of money. And we made the joke with the Borowitz report that he's got $40 billion in Swiss bank accounts. But he's also got a bunch of money tied up in New York real estate, in Los Angeles real estate, in London real estate. He's got money all over the world. And, you know, the $70 billion that reportedly he's worth would put him well ahead of the current world leader, which is a guy from Mexico, Carlos Slim Helu, who's worth about $53.5 billion. And then you got just under him, Bill Gates with $53 billion. You know, they got their money the old-fashioned way. They stole it. Good, you know, good for them. You know, again, I'm kind of hoping that there's a cell somewhere in his future. Representative John Lewis, Democrat from Georgia, he's just inked a deal to help write a comic book about his experiences during the 1960s campaign for equality. Understand that John Lewis is viewed by many as an icon of the civil rights movement. They say the book is going to help educate young people about the movement and inspire them to get involved. Lewis said that it's not just a story of struggle, it's a story of involvement. So it'll be kind of interesting to see. I guess, you know, if you want to talk to young people, you got to talk to them in their their way. And a comic book, why not? Although I kind of think comic books are your generation, kind of mine, I guess. To me, everything now is an app on your phone, just like the, I see the Catholic Church has got it. You got the confession app. So, can you believe that? A confession app? I guess. Anything to make you feel sorry. And that's one of the things about the Catholic Church that always got me. Guilt-ridden. And now you can have your guilt with you 24 hours a day. 7 days a week. Nice.
But they're making it so easy.
Yeah, this should scare all of our T-Twizzlers. A new Brookings Institute analysis reports that whites continue to decline as a share of America's population. They now represent less than half of all three-year-olds in the country. Nationally, whites account for 58.8% of all school enrollment in 2009 and less than half of the three-year-olds. So as we see going forward, whitey not in a good spot. I saw this comedian, George Lopez, and he had a really interesting way of looking at it. He goes, you know what? When we're the majority, we will treat you just as well as you have treated us. And I find that to be very accurate. You know, you talk about this being a Christian nation, and very seriously, I mean, that whole do unto others thing, that's made up for a reason. Because, you know, Whitey, we're not going to be, and I'm one of them, we're not going to be in the majority forever. So maybe we need to learn how to play a little bit in the sandbox. Speaking of sandboxes, according to WikiLeaks, and I got to be honest, this guy should be a national hero. What they're trying to do is they're trying to figure out a way of getting rid of him. But the guy who leaked these documents, God bless him. But according to the WikiLeaks cable, Saudi Arabia can't seem to pump enough oil to keep prices from shooting through the roof. In fact, according to the cable, it's been estimated that the reserves that the Saudis have, now understand, they're the big exporter of oil. They're the kingfish. Their reserves have, according to the cables, overestimated by 300 billion barrels, nearly 40% of their reserves. So you start looking down the road, and I want to bring that back to why we're here in Washington, D.C. at this Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference. If this is true, and the Saudis are overblowing their reserves, saying that they've got 300 billion barrels when they really don't, what does that mean for us in 10, 20, 30 years as the oil dries up? What does that mean for prices? Does it mean $6, $7, $10 a gallon? Does it mean that already we're behind the eight ball because we don't have public transportation? These are things that have to be discussed, have to be thought about. And I'm afraid, you know, looking at the political landscape, especially since November of 2010, that the will, the leadership, the vision, not there. Not there at all. What we've got is we've got a bunch of petulant children on the ground, on their backs, with their fingers in their ears, kicking their feet, screaming, me, 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 me. Seems to be it. And you look at this oil situation. like we've talked about tonight, coming here to Washington this morning was gridlock. And this wasn't even bad, I'm told. We were at the beginning of it. You hit the dead moment of it, it takes hours to get through. And I look at all that oil that we're wasting. We're wasting this resource. Now, look, we're not going to get away from using oil, but we should use it smarter. We should use it more efficiently. That's not, to me, that's not being a tree hugger. That's not being a wacko environmentalist. What that's being is having half a brain. Having a little intelligence on how you use your resource, how you allocate what finite resources you have so that you can better society, that you can pull the most profit, pull the most use out of it. If I have to use a business frame, that's what we should be doing with this valuable resource. Not wasting it sitting on the highway to come down to a conference or to get to work or whatever. And again, it comes back down to vision. Now, We should have been doing this stuff for 30 years. And thanks to people like Reagan, thanks to people like George W. Bush, we are now way behind the rest of the world. Way, way behind. Now it's time to play catch up. Now we need to have this, as the president said, this Sputnik moment. We need to have the Manhattan Project. We need to dig down and really commit as a nation to turning things around, Jake, or I think we're in big trouble.
Well, the irony is, and the more you delve into, you know, the kind of jobs that we're talking about at this conference, you realize it's not just a matter of common sense. I mean, it's good economics. You can create jobs. You can improve the environment. And as we talked earlier, we can go a long way keeping our country safe. We are getting to the point in a couple areas where our lack of vision is really putting our country at risk. Yes, we have the world's strongest army, but we are, because of lack of foresight, we are putting the very future and the military risk of this country in harm's way, and that's just unconscionable. And you know, the irony is, Rick, and I hear it all the time. It's like they try to paint Jimmy Carter as this caricature, this cartoonish kind of guy, but yet, in some ways, he was a visionary. And if we would have followed more of what Jimmy Carter had advocated, we'd be in much better shape. Unfortunately, Jimmy Carter, and if you remember, he brought his people from Georgia. I think to some degree he, you know, maybe he was a triple A team. The people he brought with him was a triple A team, and they wanted to play them in the major leagues. Plus, he was a victim of the Arab oil boycott. But a lot of the things that he advocated and put in place, if we had them today, we would be much better off as a nation, without question.
Well, again, you go back to that, and you go, you know, we developed this technology. We were at that moment, at that very moment, as a nation, we were on the brink of breaking free of everyone else. We were in the race way out ahead because we had the technology. We had the ability to then expand that, become energy independent, to be completely self-sufficient as a nation. Stop and think about how important that is. Right now, we're dependent on everyone for what we get. We need their natural resources. We need their oil, their minerals. We need all of that stuff. In fact, we need their manufactured goods since we're not manufacturing many things or manufacturing as we had in the past. We need everybody else. Is this interdependent world what we're looking for? Some would argue yes. Personally, I'm in favor of having some interdependence, having some cooperation, but at the end of it, being strong at home by being independent if we need to be, by being self-sufficient in times of crisis, to where if energy prices in OPEC go through the roof, $200 a barrel where Osama bin Laden wanted it, we can weather the storm because we have the ability to produce our own energy. And that, you know, water and energy, folks, That's where the game's going to be played in the next 100 years.
I can remember those initiatives. There were quite a few people just in the small town I live in, like you would have and maybe did. I think you said you did. You took advantage of the tax breaks they were giving you to install solar hot water heaters.
No, we didn't. We couldn't get that done. But we did with the tax credits put in more energy efficient windows, doors. We did do a lot of that stuff to help weatherize. We're still looking to, I still want to do the solar. We're still looking into it. But here's the thing. It's not a national priority like it is in Germany. If we had a system here like they have in Germany where I can get a 10-year loan at a like 1% interest rate and whatever I conserve, I can sell back to the grid for 8 times what it costs, thus paying for the loan, in a heartbeat. And I think the majority of people in the country, in a heartbeat, would do this. Anyway, tomorrow we're going to be back in the studio. Your calls. Thanks for being here. I want to thank everybody, all of our guests. We'll see you tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color like the tide that flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USP.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold.
But some of us political juveniles still enjoy going to the circus.
Yeah, you know, they had a very interesting documentary on John Kennedy today and the way he handled people and the way he spoke to people and this, that, and the other. And I was just going back and forth between John Kennedy and Obama, and I thought, oh, Lord, at least I was alive in a time when I could really see a president who could handle himself in front of the media and could deliver a good speech. And, you know, the main thing about it was the speech was just not rhetoric. It was reality.